Somebody asked me last night, just at the end, if I was going to talk about love. And I said, I'm bound to talk about love. And Andy, one of you, was married this Christmas time in California, and I went to his wedding, and he asked me to recite a poem that I wrote at his wedding. And I did so, and I really felt very moved to be invited to have my thoughts incorporated in somebody's wedding. But I also was very interested, the people who were at the wedding were many older people as well as young, and they came up and told me they liked it. There were many faces. I looked around at those at the wedding, and I didn't know, my wife and I didn't know them, and so I wondered whether they would care for that kind of a poem. But apparently, I was very deceptive, because older men that I would not thought had been really particularly interested in it came up and said they liked it. Last May 28th, I was sitting in our working apartment on the 31st floor of the Society Hill Towers here in Philadelphia, and the windows were open. It was a lovely, really beautiful late spring feeling, just on the edge of June. And I was actually writing about the twilight of the power structures, which was economics, and to my astonishment, really, this never happened to be quite that way. I suddenly had a poem, and I had to write it out. and the poem goes as follows. Why yours truly? I'm not yours. You're not mine. My years of life is 79. Mysteries deepen. I opine. Curvaceous, silcaceous, sylphaceous you. I'm nigh inefficacious. What may we do? I can't eat you and have you too. Let's enjoy laughter and wisdom too. You're eternally lovely, the truly you. You can't see me, I can't see you, but we may know one another, and sometimes do. Then learn that we both love only all that's true. Wherefore we both love the truly you. I love you forever, the truly you. And I really feel this very, very deeply about my feelings about humanity. I really do love humanity. It can be very obstreperous. A sheep can be very obstreperous. Humans can be very misbehaved, but I really do tend to a really very deep sense of affection. I get particularly in love with those who are participating in experiences which we're going through together. I can't tell you how much your beings mean to me as I sit here, and I'm very deeply aware of your eyes. I can see them all night. And I'm so absolutely overwhelmed by the mystery of the experience that we all go through, of life itself. And I'm so astonished at myself and how other and why other people also take everything so for granted, that this is the way it was meant to be, and so forth. And there's a big picture, but all of this is the more I think about it, the more difficult to understand how such extraordinary awareness can occur as that of life. And you certainly a feeling with me that our times and the critical condition we are, I'm confident all of humanity are going through, this very, what I feel is to be a great test. And the thing that I have written, call here, Complexion 1975, I'd like you to look in the Webster's Dictionary at this meanings for complexion. And this is the most highly concentrated kind of statement I can make. And I'm quite confident it is a very hot essence of things, all the things I'm saying to you. And it is being tight, and I've been rewritten time and time and time again. I've studied every word I use and looked at, change them all around and keep sorting it out. Janet's here, and she's retyped it. I don't know how many times these things go on and on and on. But please remember it is highly concentrated, and that I don't do it to have it flow fast. So I hope that I'm so accurate that it will be lucid and could flow, but there's a whole lot of thought packed in, so it needs to be digested. I do recommend reading it through quite fast, but then coming back and taking it easy. I'm going to, with the hours that are left to us now, go on some more with the design science and experiences in the design science, and thinking about them, I want you to think about the integration of many things I've given you, outset grand strategy, how not to miss anything, how not miss any of the parameters at the very outset, discovering that the thinking had geometry and going into the geometries and discovering principles of inter-transforming and discovering which geometries give us the greatest strength, doing the most with the least. And as we go in to the structures I'm going to go through tonight, I think you'll feel very powerfully the geometry. These are all, you remember, I could get to the point where we noted that we have conceptuality independent of size or time, and then we introduce the phenomenon of time and introduce its frequencies of modular subdivision. And we saw how that was patterned in relation to the vector equilibrium as either radius or chord, that the time increments, the frequency increments were in the exact synchronization of both the radial, which would be radius, and the circumferential, which would be the containment or the gravity. Really, it is a united field theory of the gravitation and the radiation, but finding that the gravitation is more favorably arranged, the same six vectors, because they came back to themselves, and they used the mass and attractability to have a containment, whereas the explosives, the radiants, were trying to come apart and were not helping one another. The further apart from one another, the less they could help one another. And they did not operate together, they operated independently. So really the difference between synergy or the behavior of wholes and the behavior of the parts considered separately, we see the parts coming apart, but not being as effective anywhere nearly as when you can actually come back to yourself and really know the word understanding. I find the word understanding when I do the thinking. So I want to understand. When I finally find out where are those star points that are dividing the universe in the insiders and outsiders, so finding that there are four stars with their six relationships. And understanding is finding where those relationships are. When you have all the relationships of your system, then you understand. Now, I hope you'll I'm doing so much talking and you listen to me so intently that I don't really give you the opportunity to, at this time, to begin to develop grand strategy and try to integrate all the things I'm saying. But I've deliberately tried to present the things to you coming from the whole, the particular, in a way that we continually have to realize that this is related to what I've heard before. And I'm very eager that you feel the absolute interconnectedness of everything. And so I'm now thinking a little about all the lessons I had of the little individual trying to do his own thinking, taking initiative in the face of the great organized power of society and the great power vested in great states and corporations and nations, and seeing what the little individual could do. And there is that document, this 4D that I spoke about. As I wrote 4D in really great passion back in 1927, at the time that I'd made my resolve to peel off and really do the 90 degree, pay no attention to earning a living anymore, I look back then and I see it was terribly overloaded with the negative criticisms of things that do go on, and I've learned not to dwell on the negatives and really try to assume any negative I experience is a gift. This would make me really look and see what is going on, try to understand what nature is trying to do, not to emphasize the ignorance of little humans who are born ignorant in relation to what is happening to them. I gave you the circumstances of the beach aircraft house last night and gave you my resolve after that experience to commit myself now to shells, because I saw that a great many were inherently preoccupied in the direction where some success would really develop in what I call the autonomous package of the equipment you need to keep yourself clean and so forth and to take care of your processes. I showed you the picture of the bathroom, but I did not have the picture. I thought I had it there, but I recall now that we didn't look at it. Following those bathroom pictures, I came to doing experimental work with an idea that I had in 1927, the time of the Dymaxion House. And what I undertook to do real experimental work with occurred in 1948 at the Institute of Design in Chicago, and 1950 at Yale University Architectural School, two separate operations, where we discovered that instead of having to have a wet bathroom where you fill the tub full of the water and have showers and so forth, that there's something to be really learned about cleansing of the skin, because I had the experience in Navy back in 1917 of being in the engine room and getting very oily and greasy and coming on deck, and very short while later, without anything to actually clean myself up, finding my hands very, very clean and my face clean. And when there was a great wind and there was fog, and somehow this wind and fog had a cleansing effect. I was amazed by it, without any soap or anything to help it. So I was getting into what I call the fog gun experiments. And I'll point out too, coming back to our experience with hydraulics, we've been thinking about hydraulics and pneumatics. The hydraulics are non-compressible, very much more dense than are the gases. Therefore, when we get to trying to be economical with water and cleaning, if we get into a needlepoint shower, you get where the kinetics are, you get high pressure, but very fine little droplets, and then because it is non-compressible, it really is a little bullet, and you get to a point where the needlepoint shower will break your skin, and that's as far as you can go. And still you're not getting very much economy with your water. What I found you could do would be to take compressed air and atomizing water into the compressed air, that the air itself then very much less a weight than the water, then the air being also pneumatic and so forth, it could really penetrate your pores under great pressure without hurting you at all. You would have really very powerful pressure of air on your skin and doesn't hurt at all. And I found that it could get into the pores, being really finer molecules than the water molecules. So if you get into the pores, and if I atomized some water and went in with it, there could be a scavenging out of the pores and bring the, just really float the dirt away. So we went in for such experiments, and you've seen human beings cleaning buildings. Great operation going, and it looks like they're using steam. It isn't. It's very high compressed air with water atomized in it. And it's cleaning that building just beautifully, doing just what I said. And if you take one of their kind of guns, you might think it really hurt your hand, doesn't hurt you. You might make your arm go like that, but it does not break the skin. So we got into experiments of that kind at the Institute of Design in Chicago, and we went in for all kinds of study of the different kinds of dirt that occurred around Chicago, and we finally arranged to, we took a lathe, a machine tool lathe, and organized a camera, microscope and camera lenses, looking at your hand with a great deal of light, so your hand would not jerk and so forth. We were able to make very beautiful and large photographs of your pores, of what your skin looks like with dirt on it. And you take a picture of your hand, just the dirt at first, it looks like one thing, but it's completely different when you see it enormous and large. It'll be literally little hunks lodged out here on the mountaintop and so forth. And you can really see how this thing could really work. So we got into studies of all the types of dirt were known in the Chicago, total Chicago area that you might get, because there are many types, you can really classify those. And incidentally, a team of the students at Institute of Design in Chicago went out and interviewed dermatologists in Chicago. First place, went to some of the local hospitals, got names of what considered the best dermatologists in Chicago, and they called on them. And every one of them said, the worst thing you can have for your skin is soap. So that was worth paying some attention to, we felt. And so if we could get a way of cleaning our skin without use of soap, it could be really very, very excellent. And we found we could. This came then to problems of different types of guns that you would use and your supply. In cleaning those buildings, they have enormous big engines going, very big compressors and so forth. And what would be the minimum that really would work in your home, where you could take a bath for an hour out there in the room without having any, you don't have to have any drainage because there's nothing to drain. How you could really give yourself a very beautiful massage, because it's also the same, massages the skin very, very well. So that we got to the point where we discovered between the Institute of Design and then later on at Yale project that did require quite a high pressure. The usual automobile filling station where they have air compressors and tank and so forth go up onto about 200 pounds pressure. And this needs to be at greater than 200 pounds. It does not really work well until you get over the 200 pounds. So this isn't something you just do with any compressor at all. You really have to get jobs of good apparatus, the right apparatus. We found that the Ford Motor Company had developed a special gun for the air compressor where they clean engines. A greasy, dirty engine comes in, it's clean in no time at all with the gun. And so that is the same idea, the same air compressor with a little water atomized going into it. Anyway, I now know it is highly feasible to do that, and for that reason I have not done much about that bathroom. But the bathroom that you saw, you might be interested to know, I had designed it for polyester fiberglass. The art of polyester fiberglass had not advanced to the point where it's a practical matter to manufacture in more than just very single pieces. About the end of World War II in the aircraft industry, it not yet advanced. It's not until 3 or 4 years later, begin to get a polyester fiberglass of room temperature setting, where we could get into the making things such as the polyester fiberglass boats and so forth, which have all come along. Really, the earliest of my potash or fiberglass realizations in the radomes for the Air Force. And we'll come into talking about those in just a little bit here. But it's interesting that the bathroom that I designed, and really very much as I designed it, but almost off my drawings and pattern drawings, and incidentally, most pattern drawings are not the way your working drawings are, but in the case of my bathroom, I did use the working drawings to produce the pattern drawings, and they are, if you want to look at that pattern, it's really quite an interesting one to look at. The bathroom that I did design is now being manufactured in West Germany and is getting into real mass production. The American plumbers, plumbing manufacturers, so forth, have not yet started moving. They've been bothered by it, so that the crane company has on Fifth Avenue, on Park Avenue in New York, they have little room, but they're still taking their fixture and their own fixture, just fastening the wall, so they're not really getting into what this really means. But when you get the polyester fiberglass, absolutely continuous, it realizes the cleaning capability. It's a lovely room to work in, and you find it very, very pleasant as a bathroom. But I'm quite sure we're going to be able to go much further, and I also do not want to lose those wastes and so forth, so that I think we're in for very new apparatus. It's been extremely interesting to me that going to architecture school after architecture school around the world and finding students who are very enthusiastic. I've never been able to get the school to literally go into how do we develop the packaging toilet. We should be having a packaging toilet. You package our foods inbound, might as well package it coming outbound. And it's just exactly as easy. And I found that, I did develop and made a model of a toilet which had plastic sheets and two rolls, and the two sheets then become the seat, so you're sitting on absolutely clean, fresh plastic. And then the plastic goes together, and there's a heat sealer, so that then makes it in the keeps making open bags like a sausage machine, and it's, so there's no gases escaping. This goes off into a dry packaging, and gets your dry packages filled up, and then they're all clearly marked and so forth with the red marking what it is, and seal it up. So this very valuable chemistry that can go off where it's supposed to. I also point out to you, when nature takes a terrific amount of trouble to separate things, as for instance our liquids and our solids coming out of us, it is preposterous to put it back together again. So it's quite easy then to develop the apparatus in ways that the liquids and the solids do not get mixed up. But it's been, say, seemingly strange to me that whether it's an MIT, a place where they should they have, they say, we have engineering, all kinds of, we have hydraulics, we have, we know exactly what the frictions and pipes are, and we have then sewage disposal, big sewage disposal plants that the cities will buy, so nobody going into direct research, see what this really means. At their own home, at the site. And it's something really could be engaged in very, very, very readily, and there's no nonsense about it. But I'm quite certain then the bathroom, I've been pleased that my bathroom has gotten into mass production, but I've considered it completely obsolete in relation to what we can really do in the way of cleaning yourself and the way we ought to be really saving and packaging these very, very valuable chemistries. Now, I'd like to have my first picture tonight. I remember I said I got into grand strategy where I was only going to work on the enclosures, the environment controls, and making consider the mask became a fat mast, and got going back to my mathematics. Remember, I'd had my mathematics for a very long time. The first actual use of my tensegrity, geodesics, and so forth was in the development of the map, which I published in Life magazine 43, where I got into the great circle grids, using the vector equilibrium as a base at that time, and later on using the icosahedron as a base. And this particular picture, just going back to those are the 25 great circles are the vector equilibrium, and those are the 25 great circles that all go through the 12 points of tangency spheres and closed packing. Those are the total number of railroad tracks in the universe that can, by which energy can go from here to there to go on and on in space. And this is, I was unable to find in the pictures that I saw going back my slides. I do have a beautiful slide taken in, it was published in Science Magazine, a picture of Science Magazine in 1947-48, of the first picture ever made of an atom itself, and it is just the same picture. It's astonishingly the same picture. The same screen. It is mildly, if you had some foreshortening of certain lenses, wide-angle lenses, that make things, the thing you're looking at, a little wider at the center. The picture, the lensing effect in their electron microscope they use was somewhat that way, so the square section is a little more open than the one I just showed you. But what it tends to have highlight is white right in the front there. But you can make out these same 25 base circles and complete evidence. Next picture. Now here is at the Institute of Design in Chicago. I took the 31 great circle pattern. I first thought I would like to, because 31 great circles resolve everything goes into triangulation. And you get only four different triangles. May I go back one picture again? You go to there's the red square, and you go from the mid edge of the red to the center, and then go from the center out to a corner of the square, red square, and you see a triangle which has 1, 2, 3, 4 triangles in it. Can you make out then that in relation to the square there's a 1/8 of a square, which starts then at the mid edge and goes to the center of the square, which is dead in the middle of the picture, and then from there to the corner of the square. So you find that there are 8 of those patterns repeated as you go around the square, and each one is broken into 4 squares, into 4 triangles. So here we have an omni-triangulation and just 4 types of triangles. I thought that this in itself is, because everything is, in the great circle, the shortest is between points. Nothing can want to be in any other, everything's just where most comfortable, and it's not going to transform in any other, because this is already most economical relationship. So it's inherently a very powerful structure in nature. So the picture that I had shown you of the next one with the dome, you'll see a little dome made of it, using the 31 great circles, and this was that the Institute of Design in Chicago, where I explained then that we're going to be able to close very large environments with very little material. And you could really, then you don't need a roof over you, and you don't need walls to keep warm. You're going to be really living in the garden instead of having a house, and you have a lot, that you're, most of your garden is outside, and you can't really use a lot of it in the wintertime, so everything can be inside. And so the Students in Design in Chicago went to work. We developed a two-deck sort of veranda structure that was in the back. There's the trees and a pool out there in the front of the garden, and they did some very extraordinarily good work at the Institute of Design on this work. I got the students in Institute of Design to gave them a project in which I said, I'm going to give you all the money we need, and I'm telling you that our economy is going to absolutely shut down. There's going to be no opportunity to get things anymore after 1 week. But I'm going to give you all the money you'll need to buy anything you need to buy in any stores in Chicago, and I want you to go shopping. And I want you to then get up your list, and I want you to price it all, and I want more than I want the size of the packages, the things come in, the containers and all the weights, on complete specification of what you do. There were 30 students, and they broke up into teams, and they broke up the different kinds of things your life would need. Then coming back to the, they'd work for my universal requirements list, and they were able to checklist to be sure they're not leaving something out. They made really extremely good lists, and they talked them over and arguments over. And then they all went shopping around the city of Chicago in these different teams in the different areas, and they came back then with complete filling out with photographs and extremely adequately performed tasks. Had that 1 week to do it, and it was just superbly done. So now we had the total shopping list and what it would really cost. Then I pointed out to them that many of the things that they had, all of them were loose items which you could bring into a house, if you know a house. And yet many of them are going to be associated and related. Sewing things would be near sewing things, or whatever it might be, and there would be then the things that you do in the kitchen and the cleaning of things. So something need to be in proximity one with the other. I pointed out to if you're with the automobile, you have there's a dashboard and you have a lot of things that are built into your car. And you find that they take up less room and really more convenient, and some totally. I'm not talking about what the automobile company charge you for that trying to make money, but I found to get down to the manufacturing cost. It costs very much less really have unit mountings. And so we got into the following. They developed we found out what the sum total of all the bulk of these would be, and so in their individual packages you're going to take up much more room if they were literally fastened and arrayed in some place ready to work with one another. So what we did was to say then, well, we found that on the highway at that time there was a limit-sized truck. 8 feet wide was the limit, and still is, unless you go along with special escort. And in 51, you didn't have that special escort. They didn't have the mobile home business they have today. And it could only be, so it would be 8 feet high and 8 feet wide, and it could be 40 feet long. I said, all right, we're going to have such a package. And I realized then that the package then not only then has a floor 8 feet by 20 feet, but it has actually four sides to the package, and the two ends eight by eight. So we found that if we had hinges, this made a box, and there's hinges, so the side walls are hinged down, and the ceiling was hinged down, and the ends would hinge open. So we found that all this was perfectly practical matter. If you then designed and had things fastened onto those panels, I talked to you about jig shipping during World War II, when you began to make this delicate airplane wing in a small plant, when you wanted to be able to get it to the main assembly plant without anything hurting it. We found that we had special rigging, so the things that fitted in place in the truck. So we found that we could fasten all the equipment, main equipment we had, onto on these six panels, four of them 20 by 8, and two of them 8 by 8. It's a whole lot of space. 20 by 8 is 160, isn't it? So we have 4 times 160, what's that? 640 plus 64 twice on the ends. You're up to pretty close to 900 square feet. And this is and many of your apartments are only 400 square feet. So 1,000 is a pretty decent little home, a really quite comfortable home. A house is 1,400 feet. So this is a whole lot of area. And so they soon went to work on the panels and decided how they could arrange certain things which would be most logically in the center of activity. And they had things mounted on the floor base, but made fast, you see. And there were things on the other ones all made fast, whether it's beds or whatever it may be, and finally the whole thing could fold up. But each being designed so that what was on this panel would fit in the space in the other space panels. It was a superbly well done piece of work, and sure enough, we were able to then get up this package which would contain everything that you could possibly want. and without any packaging on it, and all ready to use when you get there. So your truck box, which can be opened out, and there you can start living, and it can be under a dome. And we're going to be able to put up the dome in a hurry, so there could be very, very swift living. There's quite a lot about that in the Dynamics and World of Buckminster Fuller book, but we also have lots more slides, and we may have some here. I don't know if they're in the project tonight or not. But this is also then an institute design, and there's a very beautifully done reinforced concrete geodesic dome on the 31 great circles. And there, this was done with Venetian blind stock. And Venetian blind stock, where you then made it into you can put it on a break and make a U-shape out of it. These U-channels came together at the hubs, and then we simply filled with this was a quick setting cement, and we put, because you had a U-channel that you were filling with cement, you then had a sling across it, so you'd have cables running around, so the wires ran around this thing and filled this. I tell you, it's a fantastically strong structure. Next picture. Then we developed the foldable mobile dome out of the 31 great circles. This picture is down at Black Mountain College, and there were only four types of triangles, and there were only four different lengths of edges. And we had hubs, there were four different kinds of hub angles. So we had made little special aluminum castings where cables, the two halves were hollow, so cables could run across each other, coming in one side of the hub. There were little nodes on the hub for a tube to come on, like corks, but the cork was split open and the cable ran through inside. And these hubs then made it possible to have the cables run through between them. And you can see those hubs, they're quite prominent, of the two aluminum castings. And we had then continuous cable from equator to equator of the 31 great circle cables. Flexible aircraft cable, the very finest of size, I think it was 1 2/16, so quite a delicate little thing, running through these hubs. You couldn't see it. And the tubes as they came up to the hubs, we made the hubs themselves like a sphere, a spherical surface, but Edam cheese cutting through the circle. So you left some, so a tube coming up to it can be perpendicular, so less a circle on under the sphere rather comfortably. So it made a comfortable kind of universal joint. And yet there was a centering node to which the cable led in. So they have then the cable running through the, and you tighten this at the equator, then we had turnbuckle forms, really, it's screw jacks, where you let the cable nice and loose, the whole thing would fold up really incredibly beautifully. And then if we get the thing up, then you test tighten, everything came absolutely rigid, couldn't have been better. Next picture, please. This is that dome at Black Mountain College, and erected outside. And then we found that when it was up, you could dimple it. They're diamonds. Every diamond, it turns out to be then two different types of diamonds. You went around pushing in the centers of diamond. The whole thing stiffened up even more. It became very, very rigid. So it had mountains and valleys, and you could put enormous weights on it. Next picture. Then we had it covered with a pneumatic skin, a double skin. And the pneumatic skin was sealed in hexagons and pentagons. Because I said, you can pair triangles into diamonds, or you can collect them into hexagons and pentagons, because the whole thing goes that way. So we then made a platform. One of the ladies sitting on that platform is my wife, Anne, over in the left-hand one that you can see behind a young man in the front left foreground. There were three girls sat on the platform, and I carried this thing around. It was strange how extraordinarily rigid and stiff it was, a beautiful, beautiful canopy. Next picture. Then it had a hole in the top for our ventilator, so we were contemplating how the air is coming in the bottom and top, do all the kind of tricks I've given you about the using aerodynamics to do that. That pneumatic skin idea at that time, I said, the vinyls and so forth were not as good as they are today, anywhere nearly. But I told you we have one such pneumatic skin geodesic up at Bear Island, which had gone through four winters and four hurricanes and many more hurricanes than that, and all the snow and ice, and hasn't even deflated. Just original gas put in, nothing else. So it turns out to be a very practical idea, and it will not flutter in any wind. It's extremely, just absolutely firm, like human skin. So. Next picture. Then we had the next really large-sized dome was a Fuller Research Foundation up in Canada. It's near Montreal, and we used it in this one. We got into now the icosahedron, and we get this an 8-frequency icosahedron pattern. And I had it at Vertex's tubes running outwardly, and cables running from the head down to the next hub. In other words, they trust the whole thing very extremely powerfully. I was trying to get down to the lightest kind of structures, and I wanted to be able to do good static load testing, and these took incredible loadings. Next picture. That is that dome at Montreal in the winter of 1950. And then skinned when the spring came. And the skins are pulled outwardly. The skins are smaller than the dome itself. They're pulled outwardly at vertexes, so they get hyperbolic parabola surfaces by pulling them that way, and they won't flutter in the winds either. If you put skins over the outside, they tend to wear out on a frame. But on the inside, pulled outwardly, they do not render. We've done a great many of these pulled out of the skins. They are extremely successful. Next picture. Here then is a pulled out of the skin. This one went to a project down in Newfoundland. Next picture. And you see those hyperbolic parabola surfaces are very, very accentuated there. This is a very light, delicate. You can count your frequency by taking the icosahedral edge and counting along. 1, 2, 3. That is a 16 frequency geodesic. And I made it out of just light wires. That is the kind of wire, fetch wire. And we spot welded it. And we made it up I gave you the other day, diamond sections and rafts. And we made those up in the rafts. And their ends overlapped at other rafts. And they just got actually taped together. But it made it extremely delicate, very, very beautiful structure. Next picture. Now, this is one at MIT, the boy Zane Yost there in the background, and this one it was made out of wood with wood hubs. This is one this type has been used a whole lot since in the Dome Book and so forth. Many kids find this excellent. They came up to like spools, the wood pieces then addressed in the spool, and there's a top and a bottom circular plate of wood that held them into the spool, and they made very well. Next picture. We're still here back in around 1950-51. Next picture. And this is a little different now. North Carolina State College. And I had a number of very interesting projects there as the years went on. And this is what they call the automatic cotton mill. You remember that my first job that I had when I left Harvard, my first informal separation, that was up in this cotton mill in Canada. And incidentally, I'll tell you a little there that I think is important input. On that job in Canada, working with those cotton mill millwrights from Lancashire, England, plus one from Germany, who felt rather competitive with the Langstrom, and he was a big spinning frame man. They vied really to teach me a little better than one or the other. It was a very exciting experience. Anyway, this machinery being all from abroad, all your America did not produce any kind of machinery. Somehow or other, the people who controlled commerce up to the time of World War I did not allow cotton mill machinery to be built in the United States. We had imported all, primarily from England. And this is some of that machinery, and great degree of cast iron in it. Parts were very often broken in the shipping cases coming from across the ocean. Many, many broken parts. And the man who was the leader, the foreman of the group, would take me, this young man had been sent up there by the head office to learn about the game. He said, here are these broken parts. Will you find some place in Cherbourg, Quebec to replace these? And I didn't know anything about metallurgy, but I began to really learn really quite rapidly. And I found that there were three or four places where there were foundries in Cherbourg, Quebec. Incidentally, the week I arrived there, it stayed 45 below zero for the whole week, which was quite, and those days there were no such thing as snow plows, and the snow just piled up deep enough so that in that town, by this time, the street was going by the second story windows. And so you go out and go up the railroad track, because it's the only way you can get to the mill, and so I came to found these other factories where one of the big Fairbanks Morse company and so forth. I found good foundries, other machine shops, one place or another. I got where somebody in the machine shop began to tell me what that metal was and what I needed to do. And gradually, I learned an enormous amount about metallurgy and certainly about machinery, because the workmen allowed me to stay around while they made their patterns and their castings and their forms, or as they were cutting it out of a bar stock or plate stock, or whatever type of steel it might be, that had to be machined. I really learned all the different types of machines that you would process it to get the shape you wanted. It was a terrific kind of experience for a kid. Now, my experience then with cotton mills, it happened when I came to North Carolina State, they were eager to have the architectural department do things with other departments of North Carolina State. That's rather unusual in universities, but they did decide that they had two very powerful departments in North Carolina State where they have world eminence. One is their textile school, manufacturing, because the cotton mills came out of north of America and were moved down into southern parts when the labor unions began to organize the time of Sacco and Vanzetti and so forth. The labor unions in New England began to organize, and the owners simply moved right down into Carolinas, and the unions were not prepared for it, and they cut way down. In fact, the numbers of operators that I had in Canada compared to the number of operators on a machine in North Carolina, they'd been cut down 10 to 1. And got a lot of automation in, so that very few people were attending machines, best in to the days of my early days. Anyway, they had then this, and considered by far the best textile engineering school in America and possibly in the world. And I developed then, working with the textile mills and the architecture students, we visited all the textile factories around in North Carolina. And I taught them a great deal of kids about this. So then we developed an automatic mill. Whereas the mill I installed the machinery in Cherbourg, Quebec, the first time was a four-story mill. It was that because you did have water wheels, and there was at that time then the idea of having those overhead shafts at minimum this length. And the mill and we did have the same shafting and the same problems of belting down to the machines that you see this well before World War I. And then when the electric motors did come in and so forth, and when the mills were transferred down into the South from New England. The cotton mill owners doing this in a very, very overnight kind of a way. They put in electric motors and they built one-story buildings and just had concrete floors because the machinery has to be well held. It's very heavy and a lot of vibration. So that everything is one story and individual electric motors. So I found the most modern design of the cotton mills, where they were doing that still. Now all this also has to compound the fact that one of the very important condition, the temperatures in the mills, if the temperatures are they're optimum temperatures for production of your fabric, the optimum conditions in relation to the electrostatics and the lintels and things to get around, sticking on things and so forth. So they're all air conditioned. So they are in the South, an enormous roof, and the sun beating down that roof and spending a lot of money on the air conditioning. So what I found very fascinating was to be asked to then take the architecture school and go over and see if we might do some kind of project for the textile engineering. And I undertook then to teach these kids about cotton mills, and we did visit all the factories and so forth. And then we then undertook designing what I hoped would be a very highly automated, almost completely automated textile mill. And there are certain of the first machines for the unveilings and the breaking opens, and then get in the first cardings and cleans up and so forth, and gradually get into a beautiful twisted line, and getting into the larger threads, and then into making, finally, and making your fabrics. And there are looms, and there are a series of machines that things go through. At the cotton mills, they have what they call doffing. So you're winding things up in rolls. In the early times, just getting sort of a blanket of the carded cotton, and then that blanket goes over to slubbers, and then blankets are pulled. Once you get the fibers getting together, you keep sort of pulling them apart, and they're brought into slubbers and sort of ropish, very soft ropes, and those gradually get at the point where you get into twistings and then get into your thread and so forth. Now, you're continually loading machines and then taking off product and moving on to the next machine. So this is doffing. And they have all kinds of wagons and containers to receive the product at the machine. When it gets full, and the attendants have to wash those. Then they get those over to the next machine and loaded onto the next phase of the process to be finally weaving and making a product. So when I saw this, the biggest part of the labor really going on was the doffing and moving things around. And the machines were getting to the point where they were highly automated. They used to have attendants there all the time, really watching the thread would break, and all that's been well licked. Beautiful automation been done in relation to all kinds of problems. So what I developed with them was the cotton mill, where usually, as in building of a ship, and you go in the engine room, you see men walking on fire escape kind of operation, where you only have a supportive machine where the machine is. You don't have a lot of floor. In other words, you don't have to have a concrete floor out here for the airplane motor. You have it designed so it goes right onto the plane at the right place. You know how to carry your strength forward to that machine. So you don't have a sort of general floor. I found there's a game in the general factory in engineering, the way that you want a general floor and you can put the machinery anywhere. This makes you way overbuild your floors. The machinery loads 200 pounds a square foot, as against the live loads for human beings of 40 and 50 pounds a square foot. So what I did was to develop them the octahedron tetrahedron truss floors, and they're full of holes, of course. And we mounted our machinery radially rather than in parallel backs. It was very easy, really made very nice going in between them, and the product from the machines was successive. So using gravity, the product came out of this machine on this unless Dak came through in the machine down below, we were able to aim everything that way. So it was amazing that I was able to get a completely doffing-proof mill. And you could really have very beautiful air conditioning of the whole, because there's aeronautics of a total spherical plenary chamber thing. It really behaved beautifully. Air conditioning in linear rooms such as we're in is very difficult to accomplish, but in a plenary chamber, you've got, just remember the form of that Bikini Bomb, it just became a geodesic dome. This is the form it takes, so that you have heat rising like this goes like that, or you're involuted, evoluting, it'll always be the domical form. So it's a very natural form of plenary chamber. So we had then the machinery lined up this way, and we had the minimum surface for the most volume, so that the heat gains and losses would be very greatly improved. And finally, we had it actually coming out of the bottom, and you just really took away manufactured end products. And there was nothing wrong with that. I assure you, the best engineers in the game studied everything we had here, and there was really no fault with this at all. But it's a sad matter that the cotton mill industry is one that's really run almost entirely on statistics today, and not there's no management around that looks into it. It is simply really working against labor, and this, they have things punching really completely automated, computerized reporting, and the stockholders are living somewhere around the world, and they simply get their dividends, and there's no management. They're really interested in improving the process more. They're really leaving it up to the local engineers on the local machinery, but nobody thinks it comprehensively anymore. I found that even though I knew some of the leaders in the cotton mill world, they felt like it was opening up much too much of a problem, but there was really a possibility of instituting a very much very 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 improved kind of a mill. I felt as mills did go to other countries, and weaving is such an important matter, that this is a form that should... You could do many things that I just did here, but there's a generalization of using gravity for the automation and using the open truss. And we had the truss really only go where the machinery was and where walkways for the man, but it didn't put things in support at all. Next picture, please. And this is the truss we made at Dome. We made at University of Minnesota. And it was an extremely lovely dome. And we used then very fine woods. And it was very much like making snowshoes, a lovely kind of those we used the light, delicate cross section, pretty much like the tail end of the snowshoe. And we used Dacron cables and so forth, and produced, again, those diamond, I gave you the diamond raft form. And next picture, please, that I'd like to see more of the dome itself. There you can see one of those rafts, this big diamond raft with parallel members in it, and as a truss, and it came out very, very light. We got into some beautiful production skills and setting up the jigging for it. This particular dome we then did produce at University of Minnesota. It then was on exhibition on the campus for a little while, and then I was asked to do something at Aspen, Colorado in 1951. I was asked to give the design conference major speech. So at the University of Minnesota students, we got a truck and brought these parts out there, and they put this dome up on the grounds at Aspen and the Aspen Institute. And many students came in for that conference, although they went out and lived in this for a dormitory. Next picture, please. That particular delicate dome, we then did move back across the country again we put it up at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. While I was putting up the big restaurant dome there in 53, and we used this dome for all the students. There were students from 10 universities in America who came in that project, and we manufactured in the shops at MIT, and we put the dome together the Big Woods Hole restaurant dome down at the site where the students lived in this particular dome, as we moved it around quite a lot. Next picture, please. But it folded up, those things in parallel. It got very, very tight. It was came on in a rather small trailer. This is at North Carolina State University, and it's another year where I worked with the agricultural engineering. Their agricultural school is also ranked very, very high, and we developed a growth house. Now, got into studying all the clay agriculture, the hydroponics and so forth, and we found we could develop a growth house where letting in all the sun. That was an extremely interesting course for all the students, I assure you, because the knowledge we gained, for instance, just in the cell structure, not getting into biology, all the I've given you the 14 facets of a tetrahedron the other day. Do you remember that? There are six edges, four faces, and four vertexes. That's some total six, four, and four is 14. And those could be, each one of those edges could be truncated, or corners could be truncated, turned into 14 facets. And one could be truncated a little more than the other, so they come out really quite unevenly. But the number one world at that time, plant physiologist, said all cell structure are always in the same 14 facets. And we find it and get into plateau and the bubble structures. All bubble structures are always 14 faceted. It can be any number of frequencies, so this can seem to be really quite a different looking phenomena, but the faces turn out to be 14. And they also do then with these, the fundamental symmetry, which is there in the tetrahedron. Now, in this particular project, we found that we could develop a double skin dome where we could have air passages between the two skins, the two different domes, an inner and outer one. And we developed bottom valves and top valves. I've given you the way air's got pulled out in one instance and come in and others. And so there are many valving conditions. So this became a great valve. And sorry, the double skin, so you could have sometimes air is coming in up and down, I mean, in between the double skins and other absolutely beautiful controls. We got into not only the fascinating studies about letting light in, the light periodicity of days and so on, how you can hold back, as they do in greenhouses, the various growths by just having a light on all night so that the plants are waiting for night. And they hold off. If they don't get night, don't have a night, they simply hold them off day after day because they work in terms of actually night and day periodicity. So we got into much of the fundamental information. We found then it'd be quite possible to develop a growth house that would be a saturated atmosphere, because what happens in the hydroponics, you mount your growth, and the roots are down in the liquid, and the liquid has all the chemistry you need. We find that in the garden, the earth is simply a mounting to have the roots then dangled getting in the right liquids, the right chemistries. But the earth itself is not the chemistry, you see, it is simply a mounting. So that we can have the right mountings, and that was found out how hydroponics works beautifully. So that we found we didn't even have to have it dangling in liquid, because we found we could make a saturated atmosphere with the right chemistries. This became a fascinating matter. So then we found that we could, again, using the tree growth, and I could have various apparatus going out circularly, very much like the cotton mill, the support for whatever you need, all your planting, and you'll be able to, because it is all regular and can be rotated and so forth, get things in the sun the right way, It's also possible mechanically to do various things in the way of cultivation and picking, etc., etc. We found the whole thing could really be automated. So an automated growth house, I now know really one of the ways which we're probably going to carry on in very important ways around our world is to get into these growth houses. You can get enormous sun impoundment with these big spheres, and you can get beautiful dressing of the growth to the sun, and we can get where really the foods are simply coming out the bottom, being driven away. It can come out and be canned or frozen or whatever you want, and off they go. I'm quite confident now, just like the automated cotton mill and the automated growth house is an extremely practical matter. We're in it so deeply that these things are really stretched out. It was not just a week's project. In each case, they were whole really half-year projects with the authorities in the subject, and all the conditions were met. This particular frame was the one that we then later on carried, that the Marine Corps lifted in that first lifted at what we call Orphans Hill in North Carolina in 54. Next picture. This is the Woods Hole Dome, Woods Hole, Massachusetts, up in a very high point of the land at Woods Hole. And this was one I said we had students from 10 different universities, and the project was led at MIT. We worked on it for months at MIT, the Graduate School of Architecture, and it was done with hyperbolic parabola diamonds. And as you know, hyperbolic parabola, you get dealing in straight lines. I want you to just think about you make a diamond flat, and it's parallelogram, make some lines running parallel to one side of the edges. And you can have a uniform boundary scale on it, so the parallels are equal distance apart. Now, I'm going to take this same diamond, I just draw some lines on it. I'd like you to try this yourself, and I think I'll do it up here on the board. Now, as we say, the uniform angle. Now, I'm going to have a bending line of your diamond here. And you'll mark these points, A and B and C, D, E, F, G, so forth, I, J, just so you know them. When you begin to bend this on this line, you get to a point where A would meet A prime, and this could be B and C and so forth. And if you bring this over all the way, you find that the B make it a little easier, it's gonna be A B C D E, then come back again the same letters D C B A. That when you bring this thing over, finally, this point when I bend over, this point here will be here. So the distance between B and that point will be that. This point here is going to be here. So the distance between C and C is this. And the distance between, I reverse that, A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A. So, difference between C and C, I've got shown you. So D and D would be like this. You find that these lines are all different lengths. They were all the same when it started, but they were very different lengths. So I find just by bending this on a complete axis all the way over, you get these different lines, because here's a B, and the distance from B to B is here. They're getting shorter and shorter when they started all the same. So I found then that if you just bring this a little way, the lines are changing in length all the way, so there is, as you keep bending, it's a little more different conditions. The lines vary in length, but they're no longer the same. Once it's not in the, out now in the flat. You understand that? I made that clear, Janet. Could you feel it? Yeah. Now, so then, I realized that let's take any geodesic dome, and any two, each triangle, is the edge of the triangle is a chord, and any two geodesic triangles, depending on the frequency and the relative diameter, they'll do a little different angle between any two triangles. Can you understand that? And we find that there are a unique set of lengths of lines between points, depending on how much this is. So I found there's a unique hyperbolic parabola for, and all the triangles of the sphere or system always come out of even number, so that they can all be paired into diamonds, and that they turn out to be, depending on the frequency, how many types of diamonds there are, there's unique, for any of those pairs, there's a unique set of lengths of lines. So the unique hyperbolic parabola for any, for sets of hyperbolic, for any given geodesic dome of any given size and frequency. So what we did in this, coming back then to the project at MIT and bringing in students from many other colleges at Woods Hole, was you see a whole set of diamonds. And those diamonds then, they're always made with straight lines, but the lines are different in length. So we then developed the mathematics at very great accuracy, made parts in the woodworking shops at MIT and brought them down to Woods Hole. And at Woods Hole, we made up jigs for assembling the different styles of diamonds and making things fast. Then the diamonds, the wood struts in the diamonds were 1x2s. The edges of the diamonds, the big diamonds, were 1x8s. And when you brought two 1x8s together, two diamonds coming together flat, then you got a 2-inch 6, so it was a really very strong beam. Next picture, please. You can see that really lovely hyperbolic parabola surfaces, those saddles in each of those diamond forms that came together. These students lived in the geodesic dome that came from Minnesota, and we covered it with a white skin down there, and I think some of these pictures may show it. And we had the opening of the bond. We roll up the bottom in the morning and had a ventilator at the top, and very hot summer sun. That summer we had several very hot days, and you'd be loath to go inside the little dome because you'd feel hot. But again, it's our chilling machine. It was really a charming, charming experience. Next picture. Could you remove me, my figure, from in front now? Because I'd like you to really try to appreciate it. We've finished this dome, and that's getting up the framework. And when it was done, we put up a rope from the top in the middle of it. The restaurant had to be, there was much work to be done. This is getting the frame. The concrete block frame had been, the foundations were in, and we now mounted on that. And my student friends put this beautiful heavy rope from the top with a big knot in the bottom, and they used to get up on the sides and this rope stretch and then go around like Douglas Fairbanks flying from mast to one sail to sail. And we had a lot of fun in there at night with this rope swinging around, and suddenly we found we had company. That a bat came in every night. The light badly attracted insects, and the bat operated completely by radar. And he felt his way around that thing. He went around at enormous speed. And so he was also going around with us. We went around our rope. Next picture, please. This is a restaurant that was developed, and we covered the whole dome with a, this is the first one to ever be covered with the mylar, when DuPont first brought out mylar, and was completely transparent, and those of you who've dealt with mylar know that it's very tough, incredibly tough. So you could walk around on this, and we found ways of stretching it very, very beautifully over the skin. We had the restaurant at first, then we had the lighting on the trees on the outside, and so the light just reflected from the trees inside, so it was lovely, lovely in there at night. There were many things that happened about it. I discovered then, because this mylar skin was on there, the whole of Woods Hole was complaining about the music at night that they had in the restaurant, because apparently the sound goes outwardly, not inwardly. It's very important, like radiation goes outwardly, not inwardly, and does radiate. But it got all the all these little facets of a membrane became diaphragms, and they simply broadcast and became an enormous broadcasting station. And so that was one problem, and the other was that the owner of the restaurant was also building a big motel, and he put up his cash to build the dome, then expected to go to the bank, and once it was finished, he'd get mortgage money on it to go on with his building of his motel. And the banks wouldn't lend him any money. And they said, why wouldn't they lend him money? They said they couldn't see any dome there. He said, there wasn't anything to it. It didn't have any substance at all. So he then covered it opaquely with plastic, and then the bank said, that's just great. And so I'm sorry to say, it has lost really a lot of the beauty it had, and it is still there. Now it went through, this happened to go through Hurricane Carol of 1953, the year that the radomes were, I told you about, they've been tested on, when the physicists were told that it would only take 40 mile an hour winds, and that was the same storm. And this one, trees around there, branches broke off trees and pierced the skin. But even with pierced holes and so forth, nothing happened. Many, many buildings around there didn't actually get destroyed. Next picture. Now this one is a paperboard dome on the roof of the architecture department at Yale, at New Haven. And that was a really beautiful project, and that was 1951 also. And the same students had worked on this and worked on what I spoke to you about, the fog gun tests and so forth. That was an unusually good class at Yale that year, and I've seen a lot of its students as years gone on, and they've gone on and done some very responsible things, but they were deeply convinced of that this really was a way of carrying on society. This is the paperboard units that they made. They were lovely. We had a big paperboard manufacturing industry then going up in the drafting rooms of the Yale Architecture School. It didn't look like many architecture schools, but everybody loved it. And it was at that school that they had, I used to come up in the evening, and there'd be United Dome Workers of the World, so forth. But there were four members of the class who were all singers of Glee Club, and they were doing a lot of singing while they were manufacturing the dome. And so I wrote a song for them, and I think I'll sing it to you right now. You may know it.
There once was a square with a romantic flair, pure both on the Kim, Mead, and White. In the mood that ensued, he went factory nude, me, Scropey, Corbusier, and Wright. Rome, home to a dome, where Georgian and Gothic once stood. Now chemical bonds alone got our blondes, and even the plumbing looks good.
Let architects sing of aesthetics that bring rich clients and hordes to their knees. Just give me a home in a great circle dome where the stresses and strains are at ease. Round home to a dome on the crest of a neighboring hill where the chores are all done before they're begun and eclectic nonsense is nil. Let modern folks dream of glass boxes with steam out along Superbibia Way. Split levels, split loans, split breadwinner homes, no down money, lifetime to pay. Rome, home to a dome, no banker would back with a dime. No mortgage to show, no payments to go, where you dream, dwell, and spend your own time. Sorry about the voice, but... Anyway, this was a lovely dome up there, and it went on very well for quite a while. It was hygroscopic, and they got some rain, and it got a little wet around the bottom, but as, again, it's an interesting thing where they had some people got other dormitories excited by it and became a target for fire bombs, and it finally was destroyed. It's very interesting that nature has a way of wanting to really test things and keeps out the number of domes I've had that have been destroyed for one reason or another. It's amazing. Now, this one is really not a very impressive dome to talk about. I think that I'll pass that one up. Next picture. This is a truly exciting one, which occurred at the Washington University in St. Louis, very good architecture department. You'll find that not only do we have the city diamonds that I spoke to you about in the icosahedron, but it's possible to find points which on those diamonds, and I'll just show you how you go at finding them. Well, we divide the total surface of the dome into two diamonds, but all the lengths of the edges of the diamonds are the same. Five triangles around each corner. And here we are. We go to the centers of gravity of each of the triangles, and we get the diamonds. Oh, it goes. Now, it is possible now, in relation to the diamond, 30 diamonds that you're seeing here, to find another diamond where there's a point that's equidistant from going along this line to where there's a point that's equidistant from these two points. Can you see that? So this makes an isosceles, and I go along then each one of these where I want to get that same. Question about that now. It keeps breaking into what are called the fat diamonds and the thin diamonds, but all the lengths of edges are exactly the same. That's interesting to find. This is the largest number of facets where I can get equal length edge. That was a problem we wanted to address at that time because we were looking for economy. So you get not only the let's see how many lines you actually have in those diamonds. You have the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these in face, every one of the 20 triangles has 120 of those lines here. And it gives you also, there were 30 of these, there are 60, making the two different ones, so there's 60 and 120. The 180 identical length pieces make the dome. And it's really quite a lovely dome. And then those, we made those diamonds were made by taking boards and putting a spreader, fastening ends together, putting a spreader, making a little truss form, which is a very powerful, very elegant, beautiful unit. Next, may I have that picture back of the Washington Dome? And so you'll see those boards making those trusses for them, and we were not making a whole sphere, so we didn't have to make the 180. We made the number necessary for this particular one. So those diamonds then could be hyperbolic parabola surfaced. And this particular dome, next picture, we went on and finally made this into the, what do you call, the flying seed pod with the fat and thin domes. Here's the flying seed pod coming out. These are magnesium tubes and made very beautiful joints for them. Next picture, please. We made a hydraulic, we made a pneumatic guns where we made a mast come popping up. The boys spread it out. And next picture, then they jump out of the way because this dome opens itself in 30 seconds. There were these struts coming out of the vertexes. Pneumatically, so we had a gas tank, and the piston just goes out like that, is released, and it takes its shape, pulls the cables, because the cables cross each other from this adjacent mass. So we saw all those things come out in parallel, a minimum form. That's why you had a dome that you really could shoot as in a rocket and have it self open itself. That dome is still a out at, we moved it from Washington University, got down gradually to Southern Illinois University. We had it up in the yard, but they never put it into operating, pop open condition again. And I'm told recently one of the professors has it out his house, so it still exists and could be rehabilitated. It was made out of magnesium, very, very light, extraordinarily light. Next picture. This is one at Tulane in New Orleans, where it's began to get into the paperboard. And paperboard is extraordinarily attractive as a matter of economy because, I said to you, no way the man makes materials and surfaces in such velocity as he does when they're coming out of rollers as steel or paper. And being a roller, then the roller is a printing press, so you can print beautiful mathematical information and have things fold on the right lines. So this was just such a project at Tulane. But we found then we could paint the fiberglass with polyester, and it made it extraordinarily strong, incredibly strong, and good lasting. I incidentally have gone into a great deal of paperboard study. First at MIT, and then I went out to the Paper Institute in Wisconsin, supported by all the big paper companies, and then to the Forest Products Laboratories in Wisconsin, where we have all the art and science of making paper. And I'm going to call your attention just structurally, because I've talked about tension and compression. World War I, we had only burlap bags, and burlap was used a great deal in an enormous amount of wooden crating, and fairly light orange fruit-type boxes of wooden crating and others. But World War II saw the paperboard, paper box, and paper boxes were used on water, dumping goods all over the roads and beaches, and they stand up great. This is craft paper, and craft paper then turned out to be doesn't bother at all when it's wet, so that you have cement in it and all kinds of things. It used to be in jute,
Sunday were in paper, very much more beautifully contained, not fuzzy, making powders off at sea, jute bags, loud things to powder off. And so we found then craft paper has very high wet tensile strength, but very poor wet compressive strength. So if we had a container then full of cans, cans act as a compression unit so it doesn't collapse. All it needs is really good tension because it is already closely packed with the cans inside, so that it doesn't find any preferred shape to take. So it holds its shape. But it would be possible to get high wet compressive strength in papers as far as fundamentally go, but found that these are the studies we made at MIT, at the Forest Products Laboratory, and as the Wisconsin Paper Institute. And we found that if you could introduce at the beta stage of making the paper, you could introduce the chemical ingredients that would bring about the stiffness. At the time that we were making these studies at MIT and other universities, and these were very popular at the university, I assure you, the desirability was in evidence, but the cardboard, the paperboard manufacturers were making some very much money. All the mills are just going full, and they didn't have any backlog time, and so nobody's willing to go to stop any paper mill at the beta stage to make the changes necessary to give us a high wet compressive strength. They could realize it possible, but it was a multi-million dollar operation and tooling, and nobody going to stop down for it. So that nothing happened about that. But the point was, we found it was highly feasible. But what I found it could do, incidentally, the laminates, the glues they used to use on the paperboard were really very poor about coming apart when they were wet. And the resource and all that can be pretty good. They made these flutings they brought together and double and triple and so forth, to give various degrees of stiffness. And where the little fluting just touched in the flat piece of paper, then that's where you need your glues and be sure you don't have them deteriorate. And they did then get to some that would really not come apart, and I did have one project at Cornell University where we built really incredibly beautiful paperboard hyperbolic parabola diamond dome, and got the whole, and we were assured by the paper company that we bought it from that this was was resourceful and it would not come apart in the wet. But what we did then, we covered all the outside of all these pieces. They were carefully painted with polyester resin, so they're very, very stiff and strong, and seemingly completely waterproof. But there were leaks in the things, and so, well, we got up on the roof of that same roof that you saw the miniature Earth on about 5 years later. We had this very beautiful hyperbolic parabola diamond dome assembled, and came a very great rainstorm, and she just wilted. It was not the waterproof, and they delaminated internally, which was a very shocking thing to the students. The work we put in, there's over a month of work to get this lovely thing up there, and just came about a misrepresentation of the manufacturer. Those things did not often happen, we found. I'm glad to say the manufacturer were really usually very, very, very thoughtful with the smart projects, but this was a sad one. The dome that you were looking at North Carolina, at Tulane, and was made using the polyester and painting, and they were very stiff. That was made for the Marine Corps, and the one you're looking at now was made for the Marine Corps because we found them. These are made out of continuous strips, which strips come together to make one of those big diamonds because you have the parallel lines, this comes through a roller and printed. And it prints windows into them, and it was double wall, double thickness, and very, very stiff dome. Next picture, that dome went up in. I'm sorry, we don't have the completed dome. The Marine Corps dome did go up in a great hurry, and this is another one. In
I take back, that is a Marine Corps dorm. This is at Quantico, Virginia. And very interesting things happened with that dorm. The Marines liked it all right and went together readily. We had one opaque. It didn't open the windows. There's windows you could fold open and out as you like. And we had it on a out in the parade ground where the grass had all gone. It was just dirt. And the dorm was up there, and in a few days, apparently the paperboard let sunlight through so grass would grow, but kept it from scorching. The most beautiful circular carpet of green grass came up. And that's why we moved it there, this lovely circle. Anyway, the paperboard seemed to have a favorable effect that way. Next picture. This is one at University of Michigan. Next picture, again, paperboard. This is the first of the radomes, polyester fiberglass radomes, the one that I told you that the president of MIT, Jerome Wiesner, was head of the physics project for the Defense Early Warning System. And this is the dome that he purchased from me, and which he was advised by the engineers at MIT, structural engineers, would disintegrate in the 40-mile-an-hour wind. This is the one that went through there. He had it on his radar out at Lexington at the Lincoln Project, and it didn't come down in the Hurricane Carol, so they then decided to move it. This is a picture on the top of Mount Washington, where it went through two winters, two winds of 150 miles an hour, one of 180. And they had prepared, you see this ladder up to the top, and they had prepared a method of cleaning this dome, because I'm sure it's going to pile up and get so much ice and snow on it that it would hurt the radar signals. They didn't need to. Apparently, the membrane of our track, the very stiff edges, it seemed somehow rather like icebox making ice cubes, or it seemed to hold it, it kept breaking away all the time. They never had to use a cleaning apparatus. Next picture. This is the beginning then, the big radomes getting up to the 55 footers. That first one you're looking at was only, I think it was only a 20 footer. This is getting the big 55 footers. Next picture. And they went through, this is getting ready for a test of this dome at Huntington, Long Island, where the engineers of the Air Force then going to set about to find out what the strength of these domes was. They want to know, they're terribly puzzled by the strength. So they set up this dome, and when it's finished, they put ball bearing shivs around on all the vertexes for a large zone of the top. And then they ran a continuous cable through the ball bearing shivs down to an enormous composite pulley, goes through the cable here, and then throw these back and forth. And all those were brought into this one great big pulley group, and there's an enormous hook on it, and it was hooked into a forged steel ring coming out of a concrete block that they put there. They hung round from all these vertexes plumb bobs. They had surveyors' transits then lined up watching each one of these plumb bobs and so forth and watching vertexes. And they put electric strain gauges on the joints all over it. So they got the electrical readings on the strains that go on these gauges. They then started loading. I asked the Lincoln Project engineers in advance if they could tell me what they thought it was going to do. And they said, yes, they thought it would stand the test. They were going to load it to equivalent of the stress of 120 mile an hour wind. But they said it was going to deflect on the top like any beam. It's just going to, the whole thing is just going to bend inwardly. Well, the test went on, and I showed you my partner, and I took moving picture camera and on a roof in the building right there, so we could really look at what went on each one of the joints. What happened was it did not come evenly in the top like a beam at all. The whole dome contracted symmetrically. You could see the as we got up to very high stressings, you could see rotations and so almost a ripple around the vertexes. Each began to twist locally, very much like a jitterbug, and to contract symmetrically. Well, when they got to 120 miles an hour, the concrete block came out of the ground, and the dome hadn't gotten any trouble, so that was very annoying. So they built then a concrete block twice the size, and then this time the forged steel ring, there's a triangular ring coming from the block, about this thick, it parted at 150 miles an hour. So then they shifted that base, moved up to the Lincoln Project in Lexington. They then put down at the strength, they finally took it up to over 200 miles an hour winds, and the apparatus again broke. They never brought that dome to destruction. Unless you brought it to a point of failure, we're not really, with electric strain gauge readings, really know how to turn this into a formula. So they never did get a structural formula, I'm sure. The only people that did get some formulas were the Japanese. This is a very lovely, lovely, beautiful dome. And all the students, my associates who were involved in it, had a lot of pleasure with it. Next picture. That was that dome at night. Next picture. And that's one of those domes then delivered to one of their sites. You see them all around the world, and this kind of a mounting. This was at Whippany, New Jersey, in the Bell Laboratories. Next picture. This is one of the domes being, this is my, one of my earliest domes being mounted on the roof of the Lincoln Laboratories, going up to be put on one of the domes. Next picture. You saw this yesterday. This is at Thule in the northern end of Greenland. Next picture. This is then getting into the plywood domes, and the plywood is very exciting because I found it is possible to take absolutely flat sheets, and that they will, you make a sphere out of flat sheets. It doesn't sound logical, but you can. Again, remember this bending. You can take any two triangles and bend between them. I'd like you to take a postcard. If you take a postcard, you can imagine this with me. Take a postcard and it has a little longer than it is now. Somebody give me a sheet of paper, just a quadrangular sheet of paper. Got a postcard? This is much better. Very good. Now, I can bend it like that, can't I? Obviously, do that. That's a bend. Now, I can also put a bend on that corner, making that a triangle. I put a bend in this corner, making it into a triangle. Then I can bend this corner here, making it into a triangle. And I can go from here to here and make this into a triangle. Now, I've got one of the diamonds of a geodesic feather, two triangles side by side with a common ridgepole. Otherwise, I find that a quadrangle can receive five bends. Out of our six vectors, five can be bent in. And this then obviously can take any two triangles on my dome, and this then overlaps into the next one. So if you know your mathematics carefully, then you know what the whole pattern would be to be bolted onto the next units. So that's the way. I come back then to the plywood dome. There it is. And because it gets out pretty flat, they look almost like flat pieces. I very much emphasize this, you can understand that. So that these are, you can see, this is getting into a high frequency. These are all out in Des Moines, Iowa, these pictures. My body be removed. This was an extraordinarily beautiful, beautiful plywood dome. Next picture. Now, those can get very high frequency and get relatively thin. And this is using the same principles, but having a shingling orientation of the triangles. And this one's at Cornell, where I then had each one of these shingles. Inside, you look out, but there's little air, so we call this a pine cone dome. And it's on the campus at Cornell. Remove my figure in front there, because I really like you getting a feeling of it. I found this a particularly nice kind of a dome. The aeronautical properties were great. The water shedding properties were excellent. Next picture. This is then getting into the what's called the Pease Dome, manufactured in Ohio. Next picture, where you got a standard pattern. Many of you are familiar with Pease Domes by now. Next picture. This is a dome going into Air Force, into a plane. This is the one going to Kabul, Afghanistan. Next picture. This dome, we were asked, Kabul, Afghanistan, 1954. If you look at your world map, then you find Afghanistan to the east of Iran, Iraq, north of India, and touching on Russia and its north side, and China on its west. So China, Russia, it contains the Khyber Pass. I spoke to you about there being main routes from the Orient to Europe. There was the Marco Polo one, which went by the Sea of the Baikal and Sea of Azov and the Black and so forth, and coming in through the Bosphorus into the Adriatic. But then to the south of that, coming over the desert, Sinkiang and so forth, was the one that came through Khyber Pass and through then Afghanistan. Afghanistan couldn't be a more so strategic position in relation to the great pressures of Russia, China, and the enormous numbers of people in India, and in the British Empire that I spoke about, rather really the great East India Company, monopoly of the oceans. They wanted to be sure there'd never be any overland competition. And Sinkiang Pass, the Khyber Pass, is one of the real challenges to the water route. And so the English mastered Afghanistan, kept it as a block. They blocked the overland traffic, be sure the water traffic would do it. This kind of thing had become so obsolete in terms of the air age that in 1954, the British, who had been more or less, this one of the things they'd not pulled out of their sovereignty, still had ambassador there in Afghanistan, and he's supposed to be looking out for their interests and be sure that there's no, this is an obsolete thing, no longer do you have to stop that over the possible, but the ambassador was there, he's a poor post, and he was a drunk. And it suddenly turned out in the strategic information that the Russians were very much courting Afghanistan and were about to take Afghanistan over. Afghans have an annual, every other year, the Chechen Fair, which is of very great importance. And the people come in for this fair. And it was discovered that the Russians were putting in an enormous pavilion, and the Chinese are putting in a big pavilion, and all the communist countries are coming in there, and the Western world is putting in nothing. And it looked like the strategic state would no longer stay a neutral middle state, would go communist. The Americans were suddenly appraised of this, and they needed very badly to have some kind of an exhibition but there was only 1 month to go, 30 days to go. The United States got in touch with us and asked if we could produce a geodesic dome. They only wanted a geodesic dome, however, to house their show. They'd gotten up a big show. The show with the bird and talking cow and the bouncing ball bearings and the final trains and so forth. It was rather poor, a bunch of junk, but anyway, they needed an enclosure for it. And didn't have any time to build a building, so they asked if we could produce a dome and deliver it and erect it in Afghanistan in 30 days. We did produce it, and I made the State Department, the government officers, come down. We erected it at the airport at Raleigh to be sure they wouldn't say, after we got there, they didn't know how to put it up and wouldn't pay us. So I found you have to be pretty tough with our government now. And so did work, and so we erected it, and the picture you saw, they were putting it into the airplane. It had to go in one DC-3, the DC-4, it had to have one of our engineers go with it, that's all. And so it did get to Afghanistan, it did go up in 48 hours, going up in 24, except that there was a holiday. May I have the picture back in, because I'd like to talk about it a little more. And as the dome then was put up, the Afghans all worked on it, but it was just led by the American engineer. But I have that picture back again of the dome. No, this would be fine. The men putting it up, we simply had color coding. The red end went to the red part on the hub, and the green end to the green part. So red to red, green to red, red, green to red, just so. And the Afghans put it together. They didn't know whether they're putting up a quadrangular rectilinear. They didn't know what they're doing. They just put it together, put the ends. And suddenly, there's this big dome. So all the Afghans were parading around and said to the Afghans putting up, said, "You're pretty good dome builders, aren't you?" So the workman has been up to this time. He's assumed that the way the thing goes together, the way the workman's putting together. In that country, that's all there was. They can do things with wood, or the craftsman is responsible for the shape. Maybe somebody designed it for him, but he has to make it that shape. Anyway, they were assumed then that the Afghans were putting up were apparently great dome builders. So they felt very proud about it, and they began to call it Afghan architecture. It was simply a big yurt, very large yurt, obviously, straight Afghan. So the king of Afghanistan became very excited about it. He was down there driving around. Meantime, the workers then had found out they got the skin on it, that you could jump up and down the skin. All they had to do was the toppers jump on the skin and lay like this, and they would slide all the way down. The roof was going under a bar, so they were all cascading down all over it. And the king felt they were defiling his Afghan architecture, so he ordered them to stop doing that. The king wanted it to be given to him. It was really a very, very great hit. And it actually completely stymied the efforts of the others. And in fact, the Russians then asked they could come over and make measured drawings, and they came over and they made moving pictures of the whole operation very, very carefully. And this particular dome went on then, was taken apart. The king of Afghanistan wanted it. I think America made an extraordinary error in not giving to him, because very shortly the Russians gave him a jet plane, and he felt great about that. And the Russians wanted to build a highway in. And so the Russians put down a mile strip of asphalt road. They never had anything like that there before. But they said, "That's great. This is going to be an extension." I think the Americans did not parry the Russians very well, but they should have given him that dome. Anyway, the dome was taken apart and went from there to Ceylon, and then came back to New Delhi. They went from there to Burma, went from Burma to Bangkok, went for fair after fair, and then from there to Japan, put up in Tokyo, and the emperor came to see it. This then went to Peru. This diploma has been around the world. My last checkup on it had been around twice completely, and it was up in Alaska at the time of they had an earthquake, and it was one of the buildings was in very good shape. It was not at all bothered by that. Next picture, please. This is that same dome. Next picture. No, this is in Tokyo. That's what. That was in Osaka. The same dome in Osaka. This is a dome in Italy for the Triennale in Milan, and won their Gran Premio. Another one of the paper door domes, the paperboard dome in 1954 also went to Milan and run the Gran Premio of that design fair. Next picture. This is that dome we were just looking at before in Milan. Next picture. This is in South Africa with the students put together by students of the three universities, one at Durban, and the student from Cape Town, and from the Witwatersrand these three students projects that what we did. What I wanted to do, I talked to you about the African tribes. These African tribes had never been slaves. The blacks came in from the north about the same time that the English were coming in from the east coast, and the Dutch were coming in from Cape Town going north to settle. And the blacks went into areas of no interest to the English, looking for metals and for the industry, they were not interested in places where the good farming that the Dutch were looking for. They loved the great deep valleys and prominent promontories in the valleys for their kraals. But I talked to you about they're using their cows for money, and they're getting so prosperous that their cows were eating up all the thatching grass, and they live in domes of thatching grass, and there was really a great deal of problem about thatching grass. So an aluminum factory had just been opened up in a place, Pietermaritzburg, pretty close to Durban, and so I found I could get corrugated aluminum, and I developed then a dome. Which should be, those are the other crowds I speak about, the snatching grass. Superbly, beautifully designed. Next picture. There are all kinds of ways which they are woven. And anyway, I developed this dome with the corrugated aluminum sheets, and they are simply using this pattern here that you're getting familiar with. And we had lovely little hoods coming out, eyebrows, and there were windows of a stretched a polyethylene sheet, blow them. This dome was very well engineered, and the students from all those universities, great distances in South Africa, one from the other, came to put this up finally on the Durban campus. And the night they put it up, the number of the students decided, we finished about 2 in the morning, they're going to spend the rest of the night there, sleeping on it. I use the same kind of floor, incidentally, that I told you about that I used for the butler grain bin, and that worked very nicely. This is a fantastic economical building, I assure you. It's aluminum one, and it would not need to be painted.
the boys then are sleeping in there, and early in the morning, about four, the workmen, the boys, the help at the university start coming to work, and they came on this. Three or four of my students could speak Zulu. They were all Zulu boys on the campus. And as they came to this, they said, this is the way houses should be, homes should be built. They were terribly enthusiastic about it. It was the most beautiful test we could possibly have, absolutely accidental that it occurred. They didn't know the kids were sleeping inside. They had them standing outside looking, you know, walking around talking about it. It was absolutely ideal to them. Incidentally, getting Naga and strange things that happen. And it was the Zulus who have, and they also have the long split ears, and they wear these discs that are quite clearly the compass, the cardinal points of the compass that they wear in their ears. They are named for their Damako thatched hut. Is it Indlu? Indlu. I-N-D-H-L-U. Indlu. Incidentally, the Zulus, the Swazi, speak what they call the klek. They speak, you as a child recall trying out all the noise you make, and they use them all. And they're very, very musical. They say, nam. You know, it's a very pretty word. And anyway, the kids knew their language, and they were really saying this. Now, the word Indlu was then spelled out after the British come in with phonetic spelling, but this is the long time word and sounds so close to Igloo, Indlu and Igloo, that you have to really do a little thinking about it. How does this kind of word get around? Also, we do find these are the water people. These are water people who came up in the Indian Ocean. And we have some of those very same people. There are these dark-skinned people up on the very head of the Baffin's land. I'm sure these are all the same people, the same water people. Next picture. This is at Hawaii, one of my boys at the Institute of Design in Chicago was Don Richter. Don was an extraordinary man, and he stayed with me during the early years of the developing of the geodesic dome after graduating from the Institute of Design. He had been a sailor in the Merchant Marine during the war. Please hold the picture for a minute. Don't do any more of them for a second. And Don wanted to really go on. Many architecture students ask me what they ought to do, and I say, what I think you ought to do is to get production engineering. The only way you can do that to really get first class would be in the aircraft industry. Don did work for a while with Kaiser Aluminum, and he then got a job in Texas where the Republic aircraft, they were building an enormous bomber, and he did so well in general engineering, they did get into production engineering, and he lived with the head of the production engineering and developed extraordinary capability. Don then, Kaiser Aluminum Company, were looking for somebody to design capability, and I recommended Don. He went to them. And Don had made a small geodesic dome of aluminum and had it on his desk. He made it at home. He brought it in one day at his desk, and old Henry Kaiser, walked by the desk, and he thought this was a Kaiser product. So somebody said, I'd like to have one of those built for Hawaii, and he'd just been building his big hotel out there. And so everybody just takes Henry's orders, and so they had to make deals with Don, and there was a great deal of negotiating from there on. The Kaiser patent attorneys came in to get license from my patent attorney. Anyway, they did produce this dome, and they sent it out to Hawaii, and they had a hydraulic mass, and the mass went up, this thing, very beautiful wrecking of it, and they decided to have
continuous crews worked 24 hours to put it up. See how fast it could be put together, because it was very spectacular right alongside of the great hotel. And at the about somewhere in the 15th or 16th hour, it's quite clear the dome is going to be finished very shortly. So the public relations man talking to the superintendent got on the air, and he broadcast to first he got in touch with the conductor of the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra and asked him if he would be willing to get his orchestra together in a great hurry to come over and have a concert. And then he got on the radio and announced it on the 20th hour that this, after starting to put this together, they're going to have a symphony concert. And they did. Next picture thing, this really just went up like a dream. Next picture. Keep right on with the pictures. Finally, this thing's up. Next picture. I think there's pictures with people inside. I hope it's coming up. Anyway, they've got 1,800 people inside for the concert. There they are. The Kaiser Company assumed that an all-sheet metal dome was going to be very tin canny and acoustically abominable. So they got in touch with Newman, who of MIT, was a great acoustical expert there. And they asked him to come out to then give acoustical treatment. They thought the dome was going to be fine, but they'd like to have properly organized for sound. And so Bob Newman did come out. He was there. When the symphony orchestra finished, the conductor said they were the best acoustical conditions ever conducted under. And everybody was astonished, and Bob Newman agreed and said there's nothing for me to do, and went away. This was really, I'll tell you, the reason is that there are hexagonal domes inside. Three diamond forms went together to make a sort of hexagon dome. So they're local domes. These local domes don't let the sound just go around, but pull it, and they reflect little nodes of sound out evenly all around. And this comes to you and wherever you are, really very, very evenly. All secondary reverberation, everything goes. I've spoken in this dome on several occasions since, and it is really acoustically quite extraordinary. They've had all kinds of rock concerts out there. Some of the very best rock conductors have conducted in. It always turns out well. Next picture. Same dome. Next picture. Same dome. This one now, we're getting to Russia. Next picture. This is the Sokolniki Park in Moscow. Next picture. I'm standing in Sokolniki Park with the dome behind. Next picture, I think there's one of Khrushchev when they were dedicating this dome. When that dome was going up in Sokolniki Park, Khrushchev went over. He was a premier then, and he went over to watch it going up. He is in this picture. I'm sorry to say the picture's chopped. He was giving a speech here. This was the opening of the dome. He's up, be up on the left, where the cameras are looking this way. And he said to the New York Times that this was some American invention. It was a very good invention. This is a very good American invention. The Russians never said to me that they called it Russian at all. They really do credit it very much to me. And he said he would like to have me come over to speak to his engineers, and that's all the New York Times. As it happened, this was the American and the Russian protocol exchange of 1959. The Russians put on a big exhibit in New York at Columbus. So what's the name of the building, the big building they had in there, is a new exhibition building in New York City. And the Russian-American put on this exhibit in Moscow, Sokolniki Park. The I was invited by the government to go to Russia to be the, represent engineering in the protocol exchange. So this was before Khrushchev asked me to go, but anyway, I was going anyway. So the when I did get there, I was very warmly greeted by the Russians, and they had a several meetings with the engineers in town in Moscow, but also then the architects gave a dinner for me out in the what was the Prince Bolkonsky or Wolkonsky estate. The Bolkonsky or Wolkonsky estate, whichever way you say it, is the was a place where in War and Peace, if any of you remember a moving picture of that, where the all the young Russian nobles met preparing themselves, getting ready for the Napoleonic invasion. And so it's a very, very beautiful place. See, this is the rest palace of the architects, so it's still in, kept in very, very beautiful shape. And they had their dinner for me down there in the great oval dining room at the Prince Bolkonsky estate. And they had a number of high functionaries of Russia present. One was the head of their planning department, which is very, very, very highest of the activities in Russia. And during that dinner, I heard some really very interesting. First place, I've told Sonny Applepie that about 1929, the Russians asking, no, 1929, the year that I was started, went up Bridgeport to build the car, 33, I was asked to meet with a Russian in New York City by the Amtorg Trading Company, who represented them in business. And this Russian told me that the Russians were very aware of the Bandamaxian house. But they said that with the five-year plannings, they're all the first things first. And you're going to have all your steel mills and going to have all kinds of things. And the people were in surplus, and wood was in surplus. And they said, if you the Dymaxian house, just words or pictures of it to be published in Russia, it would appeal very much to their sense of efficient, and they'd be desirable. They would not be able to get people, there'd be no aluminum available for housing in that time, so it would be then completely disrupting. And because people were in surplus and wood in surplus, they're going to have to be housed in wood in a very major way for a very long time. And they said, this engineer said, we just want you to know that we think well of your Dymaxian house, but it will not see light of day for half a century. And right, it was interesting, at the dinner at the Bolkonsky estate, the head of the Russian Planning Commission said, we've been following your work since 1929, which would coincide with that information I just had there. I said, we think very well of it. And they said very complimentary things about it. So I said to the Russians, I would imagine that you assume that because I'm here with the protocol and my dome is being used, that I represent either Russian, the United States government, or some big corporation in America. I said, I'm a complete individual. I operate entirely on my own initiative. And then I said, I think this has some real significance. It was right at that time there was a great deal of talk about the cult of individualism was getting to be very undesirable and so forth. And I told them about the case of Walter Chrysler, making clear that I was able to get results of the big corporation gun. I also told them about the Marine Corps domes, where the Marine Corps founder made a very great report, a very long book we have over the office, where they show that they said I was able to get results that Marine Corps, the big corporations that could not get, and got it with my own money, and with 30 students in university and $1,500 of my own time, I was getting results that big corporations couldn't get with $250,000 contracts in two years. And they said this is the first breakthrough in mobile structure in 2,600 years, that's the Marine Corps report. And I said that to both these things to the Russians, because I said, this does demonstrate something an individual can do. And during World War II, I said at the beginning of it, I did get a hold of, their priorities were set up, very, very strict priorities on really advanced weaponry. And I said I was able to wrangle pieces of materials that I needed that were on high priority for my own research work. And I said, if in Russia you had set up priorities and the high commander said, this is this, what would happen to me in Russia if I had, on my own initiative then, felt it'd be appropriate and worthwhile to society if I could hold some of these strategic materials? So everybody just laughed. Obviously, the answer was obvious. But it was a very interesting occasion for me to really confront the Russians with what individuals can do, and because they were full of admiration about this. They have used the dome, they've said they were going to use the geodesic to break the deal, and I'm quite confident they have. I'm not able to really follow through on all of it, but once in a while I get one where they used it for the Communist Party annual congress on 1 year. Next picture, please. This is the big dome at this one at Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is the largest of the geodesic domes that I had a contract to build. This is for the Union Tank Car Company at Baton Rouge. It is 384 feet in diameter. It is big. It's a big dome. It would take in a full American football field and end zones. And there's another one like that at Wood River, Illinois, quite near the Southern Illinois University. There are two of those. Next picture, please. This was made out of scrap metal. They took scrap from their tank car building and so forth. They had to have a big... cleaning of tank cars is a renting of tank car business. And so many kinds of acids and oils and things get put into tank cars. That's their ways of cleaning them out in order to be able to rent a clean container. And so this was an operation where they did that. And they used to be done linearly, and they couldn't get a car out of the way of another. So the slow ones and the repair held up the fast ones. So they understood. Dome, they have a great turntable, and they're able to bring them in and put them up in their own alcove, so the turntable can pick them up at right. It got to be quite an extraordinary operation. But this was then put together with scrap sheet from their other work, and the pieces literally were welded together. It was a very thin structure. Next picture. Thin shell structure. It was plate, but the lightest plate that you have. Next picture. It was a very lovely dome. This is the dome at in Ohio. This is the dome for the American Society of Metals. Next picture. This is the dome going out. It is not a skin. It's just an open framework, but an extremely beautiful one. Fairly near Cleveland, and from Cleveland. Next picture, please. Very delicate truss. Next picture. These are going to go on for quite a while. I think the idea, it's 9 o'clock, so we waited later than we usually have a real break. So we'll have a coffee break and get going as soon as we can again. I want you to recall, as we look at the geodesic domes, the intimacy of that design to the synergetics, going back to a system dividing the universe inside and out, a structural system, getting to the three possible structural systems, tetrahedron, octahedron, icosahedron. And that means the icosahedron gave us the most volume with the least energy quanta. So that then I found that after we get then to the icosahedron, then we want to get further subdivision of the surface and get into the multi-frequencies. And remember what the frequencies were then. They were the radio and circumferential, where the, what I said, the angular and linear acceleration of the physics are all in the same language. So the domes you've been looking at, like Baton Rouge or Wood River, getting up there to very high frequencies, 36 frequency. And so they begin to look really very, very beautiful and look rather intricate, but the mathematics and trigonometry, just the same trigonometry I gave you for how you find out about any of those spherical triangles. I hope the interrelatedness here is clear, and the grand strategy of the little individual running to what can he do for human beings and finding the environmental control is something he could work on. That this is what the military they'd use for big heavy fortresses, but ships at the sea, they really did have to do the most of the least. And so these are containers, environment controls, and that's all. This is a direction that none of the science and technology that is patronized for the war ever went in the direction of the building of the land. So that they have holdovers of castles and that kind of technique. We're now going to come to the Expo Dome in Montreal. And this was a very interesting project to have occur. My head moves a little. You can see it on the little island over there, the sphere, and it, incidentally it's still there and it's really quite prominent. As you fly into Montreal, it is a major city feature. And this was then the pavilion for the United States World Fair. This came about when the first place, USIA, who handles then the fairs and other expositions for the government, they asked me if I would work out what the exhibit should be at the World's Fair in Montreal. And I then developed the idea of this being World Games. And I wrote a video about the World Game and made clear that whole idea, at which you're now familiar with, and that's part of my planning. All the things I've been doing here with you, everything I've been going over with you, my design science exercises within the World Game in relation to the grand resource inventory and the grand task to be done always for all humanity, not for any special country or any special person. And so that I thought the World's Fair would very greatly care for the United States, showing what it could be done by design. So it might really, I thought it was the same strategic moment I think it is now, but I said if the United States could really get playing, or the people could really go and see what is good for the world and not just good for the United States, a World's Fair would be a great place to do it. There were people who did like the idea of the government, but anywhere far from the majority, and so that they tabooed that, but then just wanted my building. So we did have the building. So it went inside with other kinds of exhibits. And there are many very interesting things about this, so I might as well mention a few of them. It was designed to be put up in the fall, but the general contracts of the fair were behind, so it didn't actually get erected until in February, which is a very tough time to have it going up. It was put together by a tribe, American Indians, who were a great high skyscraper experts. You know, they do this work. But it's very cold work up on the outside there in February. So much so that there was a great deal of ice and snow that formed as they were putting on in the enclosures, the skin of it. And so when the spring came, a lot of that ice and snow melted, and there were leaks in the building, which I'm sorry to say. They never really did have a chance to clean up it very well before the fair was over. They did a certain amount of it.
preparing, but they didn't want a lot of people working up there when the fair had opened. The dome is, made with octahedra, and the octahedra coming, I think you might be interested in get this pattern. Looking at an octahedron from above, so now we can see this way. Now, I can change it and have an irregular octahedron where these points, instead of being outside there, they could even be inside. Here's the second triangle back there, and it could connect to here. You see that? Simply the triangle on the far side of the octahedron is a small triangle. And this triangle on the far side is connected to the triangle up towards you here by six connectors. So we have the same six connectors, but they have a small triangle here. I can also make this arbitrarily so these points here are congruent with the midpoint here, and you wouldn't see it. All you'd see would be that. Now, if you... we can have this criteria be one frequency higher than the big triangle. So on our dome, we had two frequencies, and there was then this inner and outer triangulation, and these octahedra then are brought together face to face right here. So the next one is in here, and they then produce a pattern of as they come together of hexagons and pentagons. And so the dome is, we had 8-foot diameter hemispheres that came into these areas. They're made out of plexiglass. So the whole big dome was lined with these little domes of 8-foot diameter. And the acoustics were extraordinary because then there's something like this in the St. Peter's dome. You see, there are little octahedral domes that act to give very good acoustics. Because it makes local nodes of sound rather than letting it climb around. And this acts extraordinarily well at the Montreal Dome. So the acoustics inside, they would average 5,000 people in there at a time. And enormous crowds talking all over the place, and any place you were, you listen, hear the other voices, you talk to a local person, extraordinarily beautiful acoustics. It's made out, there's a number of things I'd like to tell you about, because it's typical short-sightedness in government and so forth. I designed the dome in aluminum because steel, you're going to either have to ferro enamel it or some way to make it permanent, and even plating is not very permanent. So I designed it in aluminum so it would not have to be painted. Furthermore, it would be easier work putting it up. And I designed it with very great accuracy so that all interchangeable parts. The bidding on it went to the Bliss Manufacturing, an enormous manufacturing company in Portland, Maine. They stamped out all the parts, and as I say, to be completely interchangeable. The general contractor of the job persuaded all people interested in making money, persuaded the United States Information Agency purchasing agent to let him alter the specifications where he was allowed to weld this piece together to the steel. It's very easy to do. He was going to have to put bolts in. So the USIA may let him do this. He made, I think, something like
$250,000 more on his job by doing this welding. But you never could take it apart. And once it's been welded together, you have tried it. You couldn't cut it apart in interchangeable parts. Absolutely impossible. Well, when the fair was over, there were three bids to buy the dome at more than the cost of the United States by considerable. But they couldn't sell it because it couldn't be taken apart. So they sold it to the city of Montreal for a dollar. The government really lost about $4 million there. The dome, actually, our dome part cost, we did, it's a very, very good figure. Little under $200,000, just a little under $2 million. The budget was very much more, so we actually came in well under the budget, but I'm sorry to say, doing it with steel, it's going to have to be painted in due course again. It was painted, well painted to put it up, but all those things are going to happen to it. Montreal now considers it a permanent Montreal building. They like it very much, and they call it the biosphere. And they do things that have to do with their biology and so forth in it, ecology. You can see those hexes that receive the domes, they're etched there, they're quite handsome. Now, next picture, this one is going up. Next picture. It was very extraordinary standing inside. How many of you put your hands in and got up there to that field? So, because from inside you really looked out over the whole fair and really over Montreal and thought of it. You really were very intimate with the world around you. Now you can feel the honeycomb of those domes, eight foot diameter hemispheres. My map hung up with the exhibit of one of the painters. I don't really care about too much more of this. The dome, I did get in the logistics of it, and I have not memorized them well enough to give you too much, but I did measure up Sevilla Cathedral, which is a beautiful cathedral, and I found that my Sevilla Cathedral goes way down inside this dome, which was just swallowed up in it. But the weight of the dome was not much more than one of the, just the columns of Sevilla Cathedral, and those inside the forest of columns. It is get a little idea of how much more with how much less you can really do. Now I'll go from this expo dome to, we're going down to the Antarctic. I did have one dome built at Wilkes Land quite a few years ago, '56. And there's at the exact South Pole, I think I mentioned to you, a lake a mile deep. And the International Geophysical Year became very fascinated with this thing and the probability of finding a great deal in borings going down a mile deep about what went on in that continent long, long ago. So they've been very desirable to make borings, but they haven't been able to update kind of the way in which the snows drift. They really do get 180 mile an hour Wednesday and it's very dry snow that's going around, piles up in anything. This is a dome that has now been put up down there, and this was done by my friend Don Richter, the boy who now heads the Tempcore company and made a very large number of these domes. Next picture, keep right on with it. The winchings of it. This is made out of stainless steel and aluminum. Arctic snow loads are 60 pounds a square foot on buildings. And this is designed for 300 pounds a square foot so that it can be buried and buried very deeply and still carry all the pressures that are going to occur. whether it really will bury the way they think it will, I don't know, because I find that the dynamical structure behaves so differently from flat-sided rectilinear buildings about piling up snows. But they're making the assumption that it's going to be buried deeply. It is a good sized dome. It's not as large in diameter as Expo, but it is a good big dome. And there's three separate buildings below, which are moved around from time to time. People have said, I think I told you, live inside the building. They heat the buildings, but they don't try to heat the big dome. This just gets the waste heat from inside the small buildings to keep the bigger atmosphere mild. Incidentally, with the flag at the top, like flag on the moon, I have now, last year I gave 7 commencement addresses. And I've been on the platform and receiving honorary doctorate and so forth and giving commencement addresses for quite a few years. And June, and looking at the graduating class, it's very moving to see the beautiful young people. And every time in America comes the Star Spangled Banner, and I see all those faces. Those kids really watch them. Some of them get up and sing Star Spangled Banner very vigorously, and others don't sing at all. But there's consternation. Here's a young world that his family are there, and they like the university, you know. But suddenly something, this does not feel right. I mean, bombs bursting in air, that's the very words. And they, at a point where they've been identifying, seeing on American flags, see them on the post office, but they see them on the factories, and that's all they are. And they find the factories are all making a lot of money in Vietnam. They've developed a very bad association. No question how I felt about that American flag when I was a kid, when the first in the Navy and having colors. I can't tell you how moved I was at its beauty, and gradually began to see this is, and I didn't know we were going to have a world that we could all get together and so forth. But now it's absolutely clear we are. And those young people are, as I've said to you, are just simply born in the way of all humanity, and the compassion is for all humanity, and it's got to be for everybody. So that I really feel quite sad at this institution. And I can understand how the all the officers of the university, everybody, it's official business, you've got to do it that way. And I hope something gets done about that for universities. But I do not think it's a fair thing on this really quite extraordinary day. And I've just seen such pain of decision of parts of kids about, I love my people, I love friends, and what should I do? And I want to have integrity. And it just doesn't feel right. I think it's terribly important for us to be able to talk about things like this and have it out and clear that why things are the way they are, and this is not subversive. It's just like, go back to Milton when I was born and so forth, just true to Milton, and then you have to get to be a time when something a little bigger than Ward ate Boston, and finally gets the states are subservient to something bigger, and now it's really got to be everybody together, and the flags were very, very cheery. They had enormous psychological effect as poor human beings were being led into battle and charging and public and horrible thing going as you're facing. And there was, this was something that had to do with my families and all our families. But that doesn't work that way anymore psychologically. And I think it'd be time for us to talk about it in a way that does not seem to be thoughtless and unfriendly to the people who have conditioned reflexes, they would like to have it, so forth. But understanding must be established about things in whatever the truth may be. Next picture. This I'm looking at the Triton City, we call it, a floating city. I received a contract from I was interested in tetrahedra because they have the least volume with the most surface, so they have the most surface. Therefore, they become extremely good if you wanted to have outside rooms or outside decks. And it's quite clear that you could really have floating cities, that a Queen Mary is a floating city. With the Queen Mary, you're trying to also cross the ocean, and you want to get it, drive at 28 knots through the sea, so it has a very special shape, and the special shaping then compromises the way in which you could have your city really arranged. So If you had a floating city that isn't going anywhere, I saw long ago, it could really be possibly a very, very favorable way for human beings to carry on, because you'd be right where you could then desalinate your water, you know, all the things you do with any ship. And you could then also have with plenty of water be get into all kinds of chemistries dealing with waste. And I did receive a contract from the United States Housing Authority to produce this. I said I received the contract, but the government can't give an individual anything anymore. The United States government can only deal with corporations, and the individual is supposed to be a moral. And so I had to have I developed a profit-free foundation, the Triton Foundation, to receive the order to produce the model. And we did produce this structure that you're looking at, and we designed it. Went at Cambridge and with MIT Naval Architecture Department, checking us all the way through. We then developed its floatability and made it a two ship. And then we priced it out very carefully, and we then made model, a beautiful model. And this model that you're looking at is a. If you ever any of you get to Texas to the Lyndon Johnson Library, this is in the foyer of the library. As you come in, it's a main, it's only sort of object of art, if you want to call it this model. Look at, because Mrs. Johnson and the president liked it very much. Let me have a picture of the whole of that, rather than just a part. Here we're looking at from the air. There are two of them floating, and a little breakwater, and they are then installable. There are three of them floating there, and they're installable close to the land and have gangways over to them. These came out extraordinarily favorable. Up in the top where they've been truncated, we have tennis courts and various kind of things going on in there, and they're stores. These are for 5,000 people each. They are the government liked them, the housing authority, so they sent the drawings over, the complete drawings and cost estimates, so forth, to the Secretary of the Navy, and they had the Secretary of the Navy. He sent it to the Bureau of Ships, where they checked it completely for its marine stability and everything was valid there. Then Navy Secretary sent it to his Bureau of Yards and Docks, where they priced it at producing in a shipyard. And the cost came out within 10% of our cost, so the Housing and Urban Development said they never had anything come to check out quite so close. The cost that did come out at indicated we could have it could be occupied by the next income group above poverty, almost poverty level. Otherwise, it's very, very low cost. You don't have any ground rent, by the way. So this one almost got going, and the city of Baltimore was going to produce one, have one, and this is when the Republican government came in, and then the Democratic undertakings were quashed. But the model itself did appear then out of the Lyndon Johnson Museum. I think we'll see this one come in one of these days. It did come out very attractively. This can be built to very great size, and they can be protected water ones or out in the great ocean ones. The deep ocean ones you will have submerged flotation. Great columns going down through the turbulence, where the flotation will be below the turbulence. You only don't have to go down very deeply to be below the turbulence. So there'll be just like bridge pylons coming up through the turbulence, and so the structure itself won't be up and downing the way the rest of the ocean is, and the sea simply will go washing through these legs below the like a big high bridge. There, one of these things that's fascinating historically about, I've talked to you a lot about ships in the water ocean world, they never could then change cargoes at sea. You have to get the harbors. But now with the submarine, enormous submarine programs in the United States, Russia, and so forth, this art is very far advanced, so that unquestionably we'll have submarine cargo. And submarine cargoes with a floating city, that when you're down below the turbulence, they can come and dock and exchange goods. So it looks like we could have really goods into exchange all over all the open oceans. And this also could be very excellent because there could be really ports of refuge for ocean sailing at strategic distances, so that might be engaged in by much more of humanity by having such places, islands. I expect to see really a whole lot of floating islands around our planet one of these days. This also brings me into one other kind of a project that I found that they didn't have any slides here, so I'm just going to tell you about that. That is very much larger. That's for almost a million people and in San Francisco Harbor, what it looked like in that capacity, just get a sense of scale. What I'm going to talk to you about now is the sky project. I would like you to think about the weight of air. 100-foot diameter geodesic sphere is quite small. The Expo Dome was 250 feet in diameter. So 100-foot sphere. Would you make quickly, any one of you, but really do it quickly, guess how much the weight of the air inside of a 100-foot geodesic sphere? Really sort of quickly. Seems like a lot or little. But don't get pondering. I like you're reflexing.
A lot.
A lot. Anybody else say a little? Because I have my tendency to say a little, but anyway. The weight is 7 tons inside of a 100-footer. Now, when I double the size of the geodesic dome, I do it with struts and not with a complete surface, so it's not a matter of being 4 times as much surface. But there is 8 times as much volume. So I find that the dome, the sphere that encloses the 7 tons of air weighs just about 7 tons too, so the air and the dome are just about the same. But when I double the size of it, then we're going to go up to a 200-footer. The volume of the weight of the air inside would be 8 times or 56 tons, but the weight of the dome is not even twice. So that I get to the bigger and bigger the dome, the lower the ratio of the weight of the enclosure to the air enclosed. I finally get up to 0.5 miler, we get to where if it was just an aluminum tubing dome, and aluminum tubing then reflects sunlight, and there's a concave inside, and the sun can come in all right, so the concave inside reflecting the sun radiation on the tubes, enough of the radiation gets reflected to go in to heat the atmosphere inside of the sphere to some extent, which accelerates the molecules of those, so they simply push out, they go out through the holes, through the sieve, because it's just an open framework. I found then that at a 0.5 miler, a temperature differential of only 1 degree Fahrenheit will push out enough air to weigh more than the weight of the structure itself. Okay? So that the atmosphere inside plus the structure now weighs less than air around it, outside. Therefore, like all such things, it has to float, such rising. That's exactly what happens to mist in a valley in the morning, the sun shining on it. The heat of the sun pushes air out of the cloud, and finally, because the light has to float in the sky. So I found that this is exactly what would happen as you get to 0.5 mile. We go up to a 2 mile diameter. The amount of air that's been put out is so much that you could have 5,000 people inside and still would float right in the sky, like any cloud. Now, we found then that the air pressure differential is really very slight, I'm talking about, just pushing that out. Therefore, if you had the outside draped with polyethylene sheet, just over openings like this, so that when they want to get the air out, it just goes out all right. They just sort of waft open, the air goes out. But in the nighttime, when the sun is not shining on it and the air might try to come in, the sun coming like that, the pressure differential is so much that you don't have to fasten it down at all, just to block it from flowing in. So we keep floating at night all right, too. It came really clear to me that there were the Picards. The Picards were the first great balloon. And Dr. and Mrs. Picard both received their honorary doctorates at Washington University one year when I received mine. I got to see them quite a lot, and I went over my figures with them. They said they absolutely agreed with their data. They discovered quite a long time ago that if they could, you know, have a hot air balloon, they found that if they had a sphere made out of black cloth, black balloon cloth, and opened it at the bottom, that the heat absorbed by the sun, by the blackness, would push the air, just go right out under the bottom, push it right out. And they found that they could have it holding its shape, something to hold it out till that got, it was simply would have to float in the sky. So that they saw that I really had a way of holding my shape and that this thing would work. I want you to realize that there are all kinds of possibilities I see here, and I also mentioned to you earlier opening great structures in space where there's no gravity to bother you at all, to centrifuge them open and then let them stiffen up, and you saw the flying seed pile, that kind of thing. It's absolutely easy to stiffen up a vast sphere in space and let it come back down into the atmosphere. So I think much of the building of tomorrow will probably occur in space and be reintroduced into the atmosphere, where we get all advantages not being bothered by gravity. How to do it? The amount of energy to get the things in the sky, but we have to always be thinking performance per pound. You have to, because as I said to you, you're then trying to look out for human beings in space, but then you have to say, I've got an enormous amount of energy to send that out, to accelerate it, to get it out of the gravitational pull. It has to be very compact to be able to do that, too. So in all the things you're doing in space, you're just forced to be absolutely economical. You must do the most with the least. So that what we can get out, so if I get it enough out, so that I know we'll do a whole lot with very little, I can get it out then, rocketry, then we can let it, and again, the right shape come back in. It's very, very economical. I hope you really feel very tightly with me, all the interrelationship with synergetics and the different frequencies now, the tense segregity, understand how that comes in. All this comes together very, very, very tightly. Now I'd like to look at one more project, and that is, we call this the Old Man River Project. Old Man River is I was asked by the blacks of East St. Louis. There's Catherine Dunham, the black dancer, a very wonderful woman. And she was really originally Haitian, and she is, in the years gone by, when Martha Graham was in his prime, Catherine herself was very much in her prime. She is today a research professor at Southern Illinois University. And they have these several campuses. So she is in East St. Louis. And East St. Louis is as near as we have in the United States to Calcutta. It's where for years people have been living in really little paperboard shacks and under rust and corrugated couple of sheets over them. They're really huts. And groveling poverty huts. And it's a place that's been taken enormous advantage of because the name is East St. Louis. It's in Illinois, and it's so far away from Chicago or Springfield, Illinois, or any other really big activity that it's not thought of as Illinois. It's been thought of as part of Missouri, but it isn't. So it doesn't have any protection from Illinois. And it's been, when the river traffic and cotton began to stop, and the great changes coming from going an east north south Mississippi to an east west railroading, abruptest way of giving you this, going abruptly from east west down to north and south again, we found an enormous black humanity that came up the river and gets pooled in the stranded in the East St. Louis side, and the great companies and for the labor unions really got going at all, just exploited that side over there for manufacturing an incredible degree. It was just no money, and people living there said there's no way you can get out of here. It's really a trap, except one way through education. And that's why Southern Illinois University began to be very appealing to them. They are getting educated and they're doing a lot of good thinking, but it is a fascinating community. Anyway, that community found that the government didn't understand them at all, and the kind of housing they gave just didn't work, and everything really got worse. And there's such poverty that the state of Illinois condemned its sewage system, said you can't have that, and under those conditions, any other city in America could get matching funds from the government and so forth. The United States government said they'd give matching funds, but no banks would handle any bonds, and they wouldn't touch it. They just stay in an abject mess. So Catherine Dunham came to me and said, "Buggy, I think you've been in Africa so much, you really understand a whole lot about the feelings of the African, about community and so forth. Couldn't you not design something for us that really would be acceptable to the community? The community could be enthusiastic about." So I said I would think about it. And finally, they came at me officially, and I had a meeting with the mayors and all the people involved, and they asked me if I would make such an undertaking. So I said that I would take, they were going to have a team to work with me, a designing team. And I said, "Design is not something done with the team. It really is a function of the individual to think." And I really got, "So what I'll do, on my own expense, it didn't cost you anything because you don't have anything, but I will just do my own designing of a project for you. And I'll bring it back to you in about 3 months. And if you don't fall in love with it, we'll drop the whole thing. It has to be something that you really like and you'd like to have happen. And it has to be something, could not be a political football where some people like it, some people don't. It has to be really a comprehensive falling in love. This is what you want." So I did then go off and do my design, and it did come out pretty much that way. And they did want to go ahead further. So I've been carrying all expenses on this, and then Washington University Architects and Farm, Jim Fitzgibbon, have helped me a whole lot. It's a very fine contribution made by the young people. But the point is that we've been able to go on in a way that nothing goes on when I'm not doing it. But they're waiting for more and more, and they have more and more meetings, and I think something will happen. Now, what I said to them was, number one, we're not going to think of anything about any monies that are available for building anything. All the government monies of states and the federal government have all been processed into being through enormous lobbies to do with building companies and so forth who make money out of it. I've got to go exactly opposite. This must not be having anything to do with money. The money's made out of it. The banks make good money out of mortgages. It must be designed for people. It must be designed for what really works best for humanity. So I said, if I design what really feels good to you, and it really is economical, and then it gets to be known that you like it, and it gets to be better and better known what it really does, and the economy of it becomes more and more evident, then there'll come a time where there'll be an emergency, that everything that I have ever done that really does get going always comes in an emergency. So that we'll see the time probably when, just about the time we really get it good. We keep reworking out and getting better and better. By the time it's really good, it'll be very badly needed, and it'll happen. So we gave the name of Old Man River Project because it was beside the Mississippi, and that part's evident. Now, let me tell you about it. It is to be a one dorm enclosure affair, but you're familiar with a moon crater, what a moon crater looks like. And this would be a moon crater which is a half mile in diameter from rim to rim. You understand that? From rim to rim. But the slope of the moon crater is a very, very graceful, gradual slope like this, so that the outermost part of the rim as it descends from the half mile crater is 1 mile in diameter. Okay? Now you're looking at the dome, and you're seeing the crater below the dome, and the edges of that, top edges are then a half mile across, and the base out there, the picture isn't quite enough to show the whole picture, is a mile wide. It's all terraced inside and outside. There are 50 terraces high. The bottom terraces are very wide, and they get higher, they get narrower. And when they get narrower, the living on it goes back deeper into the mountain. So the mountain has thickness. You understand? So they go back about I'll get to what the families are like. So for just a minute now, there are all the same terraces on the inside. There are bridges across between the inside and outside terraces. It's pretty much like bridges you'd go across. You're coming into a big stadium, you're coming up the ramps and go across a bridge, coming out suddenly in the stadium. And there are bridges at every four floors. So at any point you can go down to a terrace, up to, and you come to a bridge in the worst condition. You might be on the right one for it. Then there, inside the crater, is a hollow mountain, ring, circular mountain going around here. Inside, sort of big A-frame form, this is where all the traffic is. All the circumferential highway that gets you there, everything to everywhere it's going to go. And there are vertical elevatings and so forth there, climb up and down ramps. But all the traffic is out of sight. And so, biggest part, and this is the thing for the Africans, what they really did love. The inside of the dome is entirely community life. And as you go up to the top, looking down, you might see this way, kids are going to school, and you see, there are trees all planted around, so this is an enormous great garden. At the very bottom is a very large athletic field, so it is much more the several athletic, big ones will be there, very much bigger than any of our regular dome things. Now, a peasant, bowls, or anything like that. You would then be able to see where there are stores. Anything's going on. There'll be tennis courts, hundreds of tennis courts and so on. Anything that's community life is all visible there. If you've ever been in a Rose Bowl or something like that, and you know, seeing the other side, people begin to be pretty tiny, actually. So they're going to be much tinier still. You would have to use glasses to see your kid at the school down there. But the point is, it's all community life. Then you go out the bridge, on the outside, all the terraces are where the homes are. And they're all planted with trees, and here's your home, and you're looking just out at the bottom of the dome is at the height of the top of the crater. So you all look out underneath the edge of the dome. So you look great off the distance, like being on Berkeley, on the side of Berkeley, looking out over San Francisco Bay. You look out, you don't see any other home at all. Once you're in your own home, you're extrovert for your privacy and you're introvert for public, which is what the Africans really love. I find that crowds always try, you feel the community, things in the center of a great circle, and you get on the outside for your privacy. So they just love the feel of it. We got to get into it, then we found there's something you could build with. With earth moving equipment to build this kind of a mountain, and you'd first build an A-frame, like an enormous culvert that went around here, and you build your earth up in it, and then your road making things would make your terraces. So it gets to be very economically constructible, and then all the waters that land on the roof are going to all automatically be. Come to system, and there is a great moat, actually, reservoir around the whole show. It's very attractive that way. Now, that is the main scheme, but I'll tell you, the economics of it do look very, very promising. We're getting now where there's a possibility, instead of having the dome go as a complete hat out to the outer end, we're going to have the roof in the following form. Well, we'll have then a mass up here, and it'll go out like this. Like this. But also then in like that. It's balancing. It gives a very good engineering. Then we have really quite a small dome in here. This makes a very, very powerful structure. These are structurally balanced to one another. It becomes cantilever. It's very, very powerful. And it looks a little more desirable. Those are the kind of things you study as you go along all the time. But I think you'll all see Old Man River Project. That's very far away. I think 5 years we might see this thing getting underway. Everything about it is the community. It is fascinating to find how much the community liked it. So the head of the present political leader, East St. Louis, used to be the head of the largest high school there. And he's proposed, and we are going to go ahead with it, I'm getting my money to do this now, he wants to have a miniature one in the schoolyards, possibly about 50 feet in diameter, where the kids can walk up the terraces and play on it. He said the kids are now in the schools, the ones who are going to be living in that city. And they might as well start playing city right now. And he wants them to make their own models of the trees and so forth. So we're going to go ahead with that. So that really will be simulated living, at which kids really do love to get into very much. And we find them tremendously interested, young people, in how you really make the town work and city work. It's something that they didn't get asked into yesterday, but this feels very, very good to them. Now, there are over 100,000 geodesic domes around the world. They came, everyone got used to it first in pure emergency, like that, the dome, the World's Fair Dome in Afghanistan. Nothing else would do. They got used in the Ray Domes when nothing else would do. They could use the Marine Corps project when nothing else would do. They all got going in the Ford Motor Company, nothing else would do. The engineers found they couldn't put a conventional building up when they had the strength for it. So everyone got going when nothing else would do. And that's why I find that the little individual doesn't have to go out and do any promoting. I said, you only talk to people when they ask you to talk to them. But you find how your thing really works and be absolutely confident. So when people do ask you about it, you can really let it be known what it does. And then it'll find its own way into, it'll sink in by itself, synchronize in by itself. So I feel I'm again living guinea peg as a little individual peeling off, taking the economic initiative without any money and seeing whether you can carry on. I've given you a lot of my disciplines and I have been able to get on. And some very, very tight spots, but I've just tried to give you a few little feelings of things as they go along. But at all points, I knew I was dealing in a 50-year program, so I just never let myself get discontented or something going wrong. I'm glad they went this far. If it was taken in a little and got a little far, that's fine, because we're on our way, and we find out where the merits are, we find a lot of things are wrong, but we need to clean up the next time around to make it work. Amongst the large number of geodesic domes now around the world, and there are very large number of people manufacturing them now, and they're going to be manufacturing a little better, and I've been trying to give you some insights into there really is some new, completely new generation of geodesics that are going to be coming out with most beautiful kind of hardware, so I want you to anticipate that. What's going out so far, a few of those projects are beautifully designed, but there are very, very many that put up where the kids are just getting something up, and it works. And they are living there, and kids are getting their own home for $100,000, and that's really, really wonderful. We have a beautiful dome out in California now called the Turtle Dome, which is a complete watershed and a lovely little thing, only 14 feet diameter, but it's a three-quarter sphere, and I've had 29 students sitting in there very comfortably for a party, having a tea party, and it comes apart in 11 minutes. You put it on top of the Volkswagen and wait your soulmates were done by the Volkswagen top at all, and put it up again another 15 minutes to get there. It's a completely waterproof polyester fiberglass dome, and charming with it. They have the translucent hexagons and pentagons where they really put in like stained glass windows, very beautiful designs. And that one is about $1,000 dome, and that's a truly a lovely home. Now, we're getting into a Mobile Theater for Oxford University, which I've been working on for some time, working with people in England on it. And so we really are going to be able to have an uncompromised, really first-class theater that can be converted from the Proscenium to the Greek theater in the round, and erectable in one day, and practically movable around the country. There's not been things like that before. I can see lots of new potentials opening up, and I think it's not to be overlooked that a large number of those geodesic domes that I gave you to get up to 100,000 count, I really know my figure there, because I received accounting on the geodesic domes that were made for children's playgrounds. You see them, children's playgrounds. Of the 100,000, 50,000 of those are children's playgrounds. What interests me is that kids really like it, you know. It's something apparently very kin to the spirit of that child. It really feels right. And I think it's one reason why the geodesic domes can go on to be very popular with dome books and so forth, and the whole Earth catalog. But we will be coming to very much more advancement. It would cost less to be opening like umbrellas and doing a very, very great deal. Now, I would like to change subject from these kind of projects. And I'd like to talk for tomorrow. We're going to get into questions, and I'd like to talk tonight about some of my thoughts, my thinking about the great mystery of our presence here. I think I said to you that when in 1927 I made up my mind I was going to do my own thinking, that I think one of the first things I said to myself, I think I'm repeating to you now, I recall saying this, was since you're going to have to give up all your beliefs, and you have a mother, grandmother who's dying, you believe this and that, and I did because I loved her very much and I believed it. I carried a lot of momentum of the feelings that I had accepted as a child, that my loving parents had given me, my feelings about this thing, that I didn't, I was purely believing, that nothing, and no kind of experimental evidence to prove anything whatsoever. So I said then, if you're going to do your own thinking, I think one of the first questions you've got to ask yourself is that, in view of your experience, that there is such fervor and so much belief in God and various phases, different kinds of gods by different people, but believing something, some greater competence and wisdom, of great power, great omnipotence and omniscience. I said, what if you're going to do your own thinking? Does your own experience suggest to you that there is a greater intellect operating in the universe than that of man? I said to you, I was overwhelmed by it. So I thought really a great deal about this subject as time has gone on. I assure you that when I went on to do all the things that I thought about, at all times I was then making working assumption that there was this great mystery and a greater intellect operating, that you and I are given minds to think with, that we're supposed to use them to think with, but the wisdom, I would not challenge that wisdom. This is what we're given. And I must find out how I can really use all the things I'm given. And I felt really very, very close to, through all those years, to that great mystery, trying to understand that every time I can, what it is that is wanted to be done, what should I be doing? But assuming this greater wisdom and that some kind of communication really does come at you, so I take all the things that do happen as very much as communication. So when things that might seem untoward, I don't take that as untoward. I take it as communication. And I try to understand what I'm trying to be told. I'm sorry that I thought I had was going to bring it with me today, and I didn't. But I'm going to bring it to you tomorrow morning. I have written quite a little about what we're saying here, but I'm going to read to you tomorrow. I'll bring it to you and read to you some things I've been writing about what I call the what we everybody calls in the Christian world the Lord's Prayer. But it is not just to the Christians, the Jewish. There is a Lord's Prayer, right? That I'll discuss tomorrow. I'd like to go through with you some experiences I've had as years are going on, going around the world. And for instance, I was in Japan. And when I was a little boy, I was going to be taken to church on Sundays, and had a little paper mitre box, it called it. I was supposed to put save pennies and put them in there, put coins in there, and you turn those in on Sunday. These were to go to missions, so the missionaries could go to the poor heathens who were then didn't have the advantage that we had about knowing about God, these poor heathens. So as a child, you're all hooked up, kicked up about that, and this is the way you do get on with this. The base, what your particular church looks like, the vestments of the minister. These got to be in your association, and the father you love so much sitting beside you, and the mother. You get to very powerful association. So I found that when my grandmother was high Episcopal church and my father was only low Episcopal church, it took me to a high Episcopal church in Boston, which was almost like a Catholic church, with that incense. I didn't know whether that incense was not something I'd had associated with the church at first, or maybe that's wrong. I told you that I had very high sensitivity of smelling because of kind of my hearing, my sight had been so bad when I was young that I smelled things. So the way churches smell, the different religions seem to smell different than other, like this one. Cause this is one I've been brought up with, smells this way, and I'm used to that kind of altar flowers, the smells of those altar flowers, whatever they might be. But a little child has these very powerful associations. When I came to Japan, and I had very wonderful associations with people in Japan, and I was asked to go to a little city across by the Yomiuri Shimbun, which was the largest newspaper in Japan at the time, and the owner of it was opening up a new plant, of their newspaper on the northwestern side of Sapporo of Japan. That's right. Anyway, I was asked to attend the ceremony, and all the ambassadors to Japan from all the foreign countries were invited to it, and they had a special train for us, a special car, a special train that took us to this town. So I went with an ambassador and we arrived at the place, and they had a Shinto ceremony for the opening. In the Shinto, we get really into the really oldest of the known going religions. And the Shinto ceremony, I was seated with all the ambassadors on up in the front row on the left-hand side, almost like a wedding where there's groom's family and the bride's family. And all the officials of the newspaper and so forth were all over this right side. So I was seated previous an ambassador. I was put in that rank for this occasion. And so we were told to watch very carefully what went on, because the time would come when each one of us would have to go through a performance. And the Shinto priest did go through. Now, what we are all sitting there on these benches facing this way, and up here is a number of sawhorses, what you call, we would have our kind of benches we used, the horses we have under our drawing boards. They were tall ones, and they were planks then mounted on it. So there was, in effect, an altar. An altar means on high. There's something up and high, and there was an exhibit. Now, up the top of all those planks were all kinds of vegetables and fruits and there were bags of rice, and there were sake. All these things that are grown by nature were up there. And then on a table over here, about a little to the right of where all our chairs were out in front of us, were enormous number of fronds. It looked more or less like laurel fronds. They're beautiful green twigs covered with leaves. So the priest went through the thing, and then our host went through, and then we advanced in that group. We had to do it. I'll now do for you what I was taught to do, and I'll explain it to you as I go. This altar with all these things up here. I've gone up from my chair, and I must go to exactly the middle here and facing like this, a very erect, standing like this. My hands beside me. I must now take my hands, tap just as loud as I can, twice. Then I must go over to the table with all the green fronds and pick up one of the green fronds. And I must go up to all these fruits and vegetables and put it up on top there. And I must go back just as fast as I can to here, get in the middle, stand like this, my hands like, and I go sit down. Now, this is a ceremony before people have words. It's really going very far back. What's going on here is that human beings finding their survival, nature has something, the sun shines and these things grow. They don't really know why they grow, but the greenness is something to do with the sun. They have really a sense about chlorophyll, or they have a sense about photosynthesis, but they don't know what it is. It's intuitively something's going on with that green. And God is very, very busy. This is God. God does these things, but God is extremely busy. So this clapping is to get God's attention busy. And then you go and take this green. It shows what you want to have God grow, and you put it up there to show these are the things you really like God to have grow for you so you can survive, to thank God for that, and then you go clap again and get so God can stop being busy with you and get back to his very important work. That's what it is. I couldn't think of a more beautiful ceremony. I just couldn't. So I've been wondering how I was going to feel. You know, this kid brought up with the heathens, and when I went through one of their own ceremonies, and because I would like to do it in great earnestness, I said, I've never enjoyed a ceremony so enjoying this one. It's beautiful. Now, I've also, of course, have been around the world 37 times. I've run into a great deal of philosophy and so forth, but I assure you that to me, this is whatever we're talking about here is untalkable. You can just go so far. I'm dealing with absolute mystery. But I began to try to find out some words that would seem to me to be the most effective, because I can understand that the particular shape that you and I have is entirely to do with the biosphere. The particular one little planet we're beyond is suitable to the fact that it's the only one we know that has any water, and we are more than 90% water. This is a sensing mechanism that can be regenerated here. I went to talk to you about the telephone the other day, Joe and the telephone. Do you remember the red telephone? That we are not the telephone, but this is the sensing equipment, so forth. You use it for the communication. But that's the kind of sensing equipment you have. It's on one little planet, it might another one like it, but if any other kind of a planet has something else. Yet the sensing mechanism would probably be very necessary all through the universe. And therefore I began to see that we might very deliberately been designed to be problem solvers and be given access to having in mind discovering principles which no other creature we know of has the capability to deal in principle. That we're given this capability so that we really could be very important kind of local monitors in maintaining the eternally regenerative integrity of the universe. I want to get to the nearest expression that I can of this phenomenon that I speak of, this is omniscience, omnipotence. I simply talk about it as the great integrity. I found it quite interesting. Some of my Japanese friends said they used the word Yamato in that same way. But some other Japanese said they don't really have quite that same meaning to it. But anyway, I found a number of generalized principles. And then say, what I call it, you and I use the word truth. And I say truth, a special case. This is truth, so I was an apple. The truths are, however, embracing generalized principles, so they tend to be very communicative and articulate of the generalized principles, so you really feel them as principle. Therefore, you call it truth. But so these special case experiences or truths then tend to lead. You never get to any exactitude, this, as Heisenberg makes it clear, so we simply can get a little closer to the truth. And so I see there is approaching of truths, and that's why I then talk about then God as being the synergetic integral of all truths. And I say these are just words, they're so utterly inadequate, Morgan, but it's very important to use at least the clues, the things that give me such a deeper feeling. Tomorrow, when I will be able to read these things, I would like to, because I have written what I do, what I call praying radio, and I think it would be better to wait and read what I have than to try to memorize it through or to say it to you now. But I just have to have you understand that in all the things I've done, absolutely nothing is compared to, the only thing that has counted all the way through has been my really utterly deep feeling of God. But you use the word, it's so inadequate. But I feel that, as I'll read you tomorrow, a God that doesn't need any proselytizing, a God that is God, a God that I don't have to suggest what to do to. Doesn't need information from me. It knows all about it, knows everything. So that I don't need to have to make bargains with. I don't have to have it that way. So I don't pray to God I feel you can only talk to God on behalf of everybody. All in my attempt to talk to God is always, I'm just trying to think about everybody and keep thinking about everybody. I really mean everybody, and if I can get enough to think about that, then I can really talk. We will try to talk to God. I can only talk to God in the church of everybody. Now, I have had experiences as I've gone along that really make me feel that God is interested in what I'm doing. I assure you that this has been, this gets to be really quite a difficult matter to talk about, because again, it gets to be much too sensitive, because I don't think you shouldn't talk very much about it. But I certainly have, the big show, everything is God to me. And I feel that when I get to, I try to describe phenomena love. Somebody asked about that. By love, I mean omni-inclusive, exquisitely considerate. Because at the finest and the largest, it's the whole is utterly embracing. It doesn't have any exceptions, it just loves. In my lifetime, as for humanity, it's been going through the things it has been going through. it has not seemed wise to try to talk about these things. I think lots of people say, call me a mechanic, a technocrat, things like that, because I don't talk about the things that really count the most that way. Because I'm not here to proselytize. I feel God is great. I don't have to do any promotion of God. God can't be promoted. God is God. Utterly powerful. So I don't see it in the terms of a God who would have a special people or anything chosen, anything. It has to be God. Well, I think the things that I will give you to read tomorrow, I'll read it out loud, and some of it's been published, and I can tell you where you'll find it. This is in Intuition, book Intuition. The back, I have this the Lord's Prayer in there, but that's something I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite as I rethink it, and after a while I find my thinking has evolved to the point where I suddenly feel a compulsion, I better write that out the way I'm saying it now. There's something you think through always. You don't do any recitations of words, you don't get in any posture. It must be this absolute line of thinking. You're absolutely best thinking. Communicate. Anyway, at the first or the second session I had with you, I said something as I was going along. This is something I have to, this is a discipline I'm giving myself to. This is, for the moment, I seem to be maybe going away from that subject. Not really so, but the things that I have felt with so-and-so, and I've felt for a long time, I'm used to saying something, but suddenly I've learned that's not so that way. And I find myself in stage saying something and having to say, I take that back, that's not the way it is, I've learned better. I've had to correct myself publicly many times. On occasion, during that second time, there's something I said. In a sense, it was not important, the kind. But I realized something I said was exaggerated. It was not that way. But I'd already gone by, and I didn't want to stop my discourse to talk about it. I should have usually. When that evening, I felt very bad because I hadn't stopped and collected myself in your presence. But I felt that I can't end this session without telling you that there's something that I said to you. It was not that way, that I really knew better, but in momentum, condition, reflex, it says that way. And this is something I have to really be sure to let people know that that's the way I deal. So I want to just tell you that I did have such an item. It really is not a flaw in the information. If you really went back and found what it was, as I remember, it doesn't really change the arguments in any kind of way. It's just a wrong magnitude, but an unimportant. I could not finish without telling you, as a client of mine, that I must tell you that I said something that I knew in a second that it was not that way, but I didn't stop myself to correct that time, which would have bothered me, and that's what I'm talking about. But I didn't discipline myself to stop at that moment, correct at that moment. That I let anything stay in this meeting of ours, and any kind of a flaw, to me, it was very, very bad. But I'm confident by saying what I'm saying, the flaw is limited because the information was not one that is going to tip you, get you wrong angles on anything. I think that this, because I don't know quite what more to say without, I would like to read the things to you that I have, and I did put them in the folio to take, and I left them in the office instead of bringing them over here by chance. I'm sorry. I was going to talk this and read it tonight. But we will do that tomorrow, because we're going to have quite a long time. There's a lot of time for questions, and I think that as you ask me questions, we're going to do an enormous amount of cross-referencing all the experiences we've been having here together. I am content that I have confronted you with much that I find myself confronted with in life. That I It would take a whole lifetime to tell you all the details, obviously. That's how long it took, a lifetime. But I think I've given you highlights, and particularly the color, the pistols I'm in it, to cull out what I find to be, what seems to be the operative significance in a big way. I would like it very much if you would try to read this thing before you come meet with me tomorrow. I'd like to hear from, especially from you, as to whether you feel that, I know it's tough reading, but you've gotten to know me pretty well during my experience of producing the Synergetics book, which incidentally I understand the copy has arrived in New York today from the press, actually, and that I may get a copy over the weekend. But this is almost a half century of work in there. That is there, and we know of many flaws, and there are many ways. We've already written certainly more than 100 pages more of a second edition, haven't we? But doing this together with Sonny Abloy, sitting back there, so it's a wonderful night. And incidentally, he's made intimate notes, minute by minute, of everything I've said in this session. So that if any time I want to go back and really find anything, so he's got those beautiful notes made. Sonny, all through my developing this book, first place said, I will never write anything for you, Bucky, but I'm going to continue to confront you with yourself. And you say, in such a major work, you're going to have definitions and words and very extraordinary clean meaning for words that you use. And you're coming into that world of science where they're using the word particle and they don't mean particle, and we mustn't be guilty of that. And if there are no straight lines, what do you say? Now, we have developed language in that book, and I think you'll probably find it least interesting, having had the experience you've had with me. You may find it really quite satisfactory. But in reading this piece that I've given you, The Complexion of 1975, you will be experiencing a lot of the consequence of my really staying in terribly tight on words and not allowing myself to use any word that I don't have a really clear experiential reference meaning for. Well, let us say good night, and I feel a little bit soft here, because what we're talking about is so untalkable. But I don't believe, I'm just overwhelmed by God.